why is it that when people give a statement to say that Martin Bormann was certainly here, he lived at that address. I mean, come on, Mengele was here. Karl Wernert was here. Adolf Eichmann was here. Klaus Barbie was here. I mean, how many need to be here, but the money man's not here?
So, it's Friday afternoon. Welcome to the BCFM Online Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, Trump says he's had enough negotiating with China. Can he say that? And why might it matter? Also, the FBI released the name of a top Saudi intelligence official in Washington who helped the 9/11 hijackers while they were preparing to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. We all know bin Laden was a Saudi, but is this the Saudi government in an act of war against the USA? Why might they have released this now, and was it really an accident? Also, a nanotech vaccine for COVID-19, according to Whitney Webb. How? And when will it come? What will be in the concoction injected into us? Will it be an ordinary vaccine? If it's made by Bill Gates, DARPA and the Department of Defense, is there any truth to these stories? Also, we review two books, Jeffrey Robinson's Merger, How Organized Crime is Taking Over the World, and Christians Being Censored in the US, James Perloff's Truth is a Lonely Warrior. We hear from him about the idea of a major crisis being a Kissinger-esque push for a world government, and whether that might actually be a good idea. Also, work on the end times prophecies. Perloff thinks we may be seeing a war in heaven unfolding down here before our eyes. That's all in the second hour. And joining us, though, to review this week's news, it's prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox. Hi, James, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Very well. I think we should probably start, though, by talking about the delay to the elections. Is this something that you understand, you support? Because really it's given Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, from the Labour Party, a free pass for a year.
Yeah, I think given the sort of unprecedented situation that we were in, it made sense to delay it by about a year, given that we don't know the full extent of the reach of the virus yet and if it's going to come back. And obviously, we want as many people to participate in the democratic process as possible. I'm concerned that we are now, that the mayor and the Labour Party are now acting beyond their mandate given to them in the last election. And I would hope that the mayor will use this year to try and really create consensus within the council house and not run it as a Marvin Rees Labour Party administration, but more a rainbow administration, trying to get in as many people as possible for this one extra year that he's been given. I won't hold my breath, but I think that would be the mature, sensible and right thing to do, given the circumstances.
Well, I mean, this is the platform that Marvin Rees on was with a kind of a rainbow cabinet, and he did originally have that. Martin, do you think there's any prospect? Why should Marvin Rees include anyone from other parties in his cabinet?
Well, as you know, he inherited a rainbow cabinet from George Ferguson, and he ultimately then moved towards
Because, Martin, it wasn't just inherited, was it? He actually set that out in his stall for his manifesto.
Yeah, he did, and then
he
reverted, if you like, to what's normal in other major cities in the country, which is a party political administration. So he's not doing anything different from Andy Burnham in Manchester or Sadiq Khan in London.
No, but the point is, he is doing something different to what he was actually elected to do in 2016.
Yes, and the electorate will have their view on that when it comes to the ballot box when the election's finally called. I personally was quite unhappy with the Labour Party going into coalition with Ferguson, but when it happened, I then reconciled myself to it. And then, of course, we then got Marvin Rees decided he was going to continue with the same kind of setup. But it's within his powers, as laid down by the Conservative government who created mayors, and I'm not someone who's in favour of mayors, that they can do pretty much what they like. That's the whole idea of having them. I don't agree with it, but that's it. That's what it's about.
Also, Martin, before we go back to James, there is this whole business of top pay. In Marvin Rees's, this is not 4 years ago, but this is his April 29, 2019 re-election statement. He actually says in there he's reducing City Hall senior management and freezing top pay. So he's not doing that, is he? He's actually increasing his own pay by something like 12.5% at a time when many other people in politics, because of all these measures that are taking and the hardship being suffered, are actually reducing their pay. So that does seem like he's actually not doing what he said even just a year ago.
Well, you'll have to ask him about that, Tony. I don't know exactly what policies he's pursuing.
Well, it would be lovely. I'd love to ask him, Martin.
Well, I know.
I'm
not in a position to defend that. I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion, to be honest with you.
All right. James, what do you make of the mayor's 12.5% pay rise? He's giving himself a £9,000 extra as of the beginning of this next financial year, I think.
Well, I think there are a number of sort of different aspects within that, within the events of what's happened. I mean, this wasn't Marvin saying, I'm going to give myself an extra 12.5% pay rise. This was an independent body. And as far as I'm aware, it's all above board. And what I think is quite unfortunate and maybe shows a bit of a lack of political awareness is the timing of all this coming out when not only are we going through a massive crisis with COVID-19, but also that it's looking that like local authorities are going to be even more burdened going into the next few years. So I think, you know, nobody likes it when politicians get pay rises. I'm going to be one of the unpopular ones and say I think most politicians do earn their pay. Some very famously don't. And it's, I think, meant that there is a atmosphere of distrust between the public and politicians in many cases. But it is a job. It is a tough job and they should get paid, I think, a fair wage for it. What that fair wage is, I'm not in a position to say. And that's why I think it's important that it stays under the purview of independent commissions.
I mean, the idea now is that politicians seem to be being, there seems to be this sort of idea around, particularly coming from people like Business West, that, you know, politicians have got a right to be paid the same as, same sort of levels as an equivalent in the private sector.
Well, what would the equivalent be in that? I think it's a very difficult balancing act to make because you want people who are obviously there because their primary motivation is public service, not financial gain. But in order to, I think, get the most talented people in, you do have to ensure that there is the right compensation. But having said that, I look at the salary of councillors and I think that perhaps the mayor should have resisted the pay rise for himself in his one role and made sure that councillors are actually paid a decent amount so that I'm of the opinion that being a councillor should be in many cases a full-time job because of the barrier that it creates to people who can't afford to take that time off from work to be a councillor and to represent their communities. So I think, you know, it is always going to be a tough conversation to have of how much should a politician get paid. But I don't think it should be in the same remit as those in the private sector.
Okay. Marvin Rees has called, you touched on this, James, has called for £90 million from central government to cover some of the costs, not even all of the costs, of the pandemic here in Bristol. He doesn't seem to be being listened to by Westminster.
No, and we have seen, I think, you know, even over the last 10 years or so, we've seen funding, central government funding to local authorities being reduced and reduced and reduced. Obviously, with this pandemic, there is now a much greater need on local authorities to take more direct action. So I think he's absolutely right in making the call for that £90 million. He should even perhaps go further. But I think what people in Bristol and perhaps even people in the government would have more confidence in is if we were assured that over the next year, Marvin wasn't going to be given basically free rein to spend this money on whatever he wanted, with some of the vanity projects that have been suggested in the past. and that this £90 million is given to those services, whether it be helping those disadvantaged in schools who've been put at a who've been put at more of a disadvantage because of this, giving more money to our adult social care needs, not on things like a an underground for Bristol.
Now, before we get into have a listen to some of the Prime Minister's questions this week, I thought it'd be, you know, be helpful just to give Martin and James, Martin from the Labour Party and James from the Lib Dems, there, just a couple of minutes or a minute maybe to give us their take on the pandemic and particularly on the response and the at the moment the attempt it seems by Boris and Westminster to slowly come out of this lockdown. So maybe you first, James Cox from the Lib Dems. What do you think of the response to the pandemic and now the preparations to end the lockdown?
I think the response was perhaps a bit too slow, particularly on things like testing, when we were constantly assured that it was going to happen in these hundreds of thousands of numbers that just never materialised. It has, I think, exposed the great disparity of preparation and wealth in this country, and the fact that, you know, there are so many people for whom losing 20% of their pay is the difference between being able to pay their rent or not, being able to pay their mortgage or not. I think going forward, any suggestion that there is going to be a tapering off of the lockdown has to be not only rigorously within the evidence of the science shown, but we as the public should be able to scrutinise that evidence that's being presented. But I think if the government needs to absolutely do one thing, it is be clear and consistent with its messaging and make sure that there's none of this sort of two messages going on at once, that you can go to work, that you can't go to work, or you can use public transport, but don't use public transport. Make sure that you are being clear and consistent with people so that they follow the rules and they do what is best in the need of public health.
Martin, what's your thoughts on the, I mean, this is a, basically like a kind of tidal wave of a germ arriving in Britain. The government's got to do something about it. What do you think of their response and the way they're now trying to restore the economy?
Well, I broadly agree with what's just been said, although I'd put it a bit stronger. I think the decision not to test at the early stages and that we were going to go for a herd immunity strategy will, with hindsight, be seen to be absolutely wrong. And, of course, the government itself admits now that they shouldn't have done that. But, of course, that probably largely explains the fact that we're a huge number of deaths that we've had. And I think the also, of course, the lockdown advice on Sunday from Boris Johnson was absolutely confusing and totally wrong. And basically, they shouldn't have. You can't have a lockdown until you've got a testing regime in place. We haven't got a testing regime, and that's why they didn't want to pursue testing, because they didn't have the capacity
to
do.
Martin, surely the idea was that you have a lockdown until you've got a testing regime in place, and they now have.
Well, they haven't. That's the problem, and they haven't had one. We've now got community transmission. If you look at New Zealand and South Korea and places that have and Kerala in southern India, they basically stopped everybody coming into the country and tested everybody, so they're able to chase down individual community transmissions. We're nowhere near that in this country, but pressure to open the economy up, as other countries now, like New Zealand, are opening up, we can't do that because we didn't do the right stuff at the beginning. We left the stable door open, the horse bolted, the horse is still running around the field, and we're now saying we're going to move to stage two when we're not in a position to do so. And of course, ultimately, this will have dramatic both health and economic effects. And hopefully, people will draw the relevant conclusions about the competence of the government.
The Swedish epidemiologist who's behind their lockdown, Johan Giesecke, he's pointed particularly to care homes as being a massive failure here. He said that the hard lockdown, they've got what they call a soft lockdown. It's a bit like hard and soft Brexit, I suppose. The hard lockdown we've got here, he said, was designed to protect people in care homes, but it's completely failed to do that.
Well, the reason, if you're asking me about that, the reason for that is that they were trying to protect the NHS. So they were clearing people out of the NHS hospitals and sending them to care homes. This has always been a problem. The marriage between social care and national health has been a major problem for years. I would argue, as Andy Burnham argues, that social care should be part of the National Health Service so that it isn't basically funded through a different stream, through local authorities, etc. And the mismanagement of our health service over many years and the social care services are being cruelly exposed by this crisis.
James, what do you think about the care homes particularly?
I mean, it's absolutely tragic. Of course, I think the ONS figure showed it was about 40% of infections now coming from care homes. I just wanted to touch on Martin's point about bringing social care into the NHS. I think he's absolutely right. This has long been a political football that's been kicked around for too long. And everyone talks about we need to find a solution to the crisis. We need to find a solution to the crisis. But we've been talking about that for about 10, 15 years at least. So I think bringing social care into the National Health Service and creating a National Health and Care Service where you have one funding stream, everyone can talk to each other. It's not run by disparate local authorities, each with different policies and each part privatising this and part privatising that, is absolutely vital. I'm currently staying with my partner and her mother is a care worker. She's been on very difficult 12-hour shifts. And so it has sort of given a really, I think, dire reflection on what is currently going on in care homes, because it's difficult to social distance anyway. It's difficult to ensure that people are continually washing their hands, being mindful, etc., etc. When you're doing that with people in care homes, when you're doing that with people who might be suffering from dementia, might be suffering from other issues with mental ill health, you really are making it difficult. And when you're not supplying care homes with the right PPE, the personal protective equipment, then you're making that job not only for carers but for those within the care homes even more difficult. So I think the issue around care homes is the ultimate national scandal that will come out of this if the government and when the government answers the Liberal Democrats' calls for an inquiry into what decisions were made and on what evidence they were made from.
Okay, well, it's all very well to talk about inquiries, but what about now? What should they do now, James?
Well, we absolutely see an increase in testing and personal protective equipment, particularly in care homes. At the moment, from what I gather, my would-be mother-in-law has just been tested about a week ago, and she's still not had her result back. A week ago. And she's still going into work, still doing these 12-hour shifts. Yes, she's in PPE, and there are all sorts of measures going in there. But it's still not good enough to know that she could be carrying the virus and still going into work because she has to be there to help people.
Amazing. I mean, Johan Giesecke, I mentioned this epidemiologist, he's one of the top in the world. He's part of the World Health Organization, although he does disagree with some of their policies. He's penned a letter to The Lancet, the medical paper, which was published this week, and it's called The Invisible Pandemic. This is, I suppose, one of the key things about this is that it is being passed around without anybody realising it. Measures to flatten the curve, he says, might have an effect, but a lockdown only pushes the severe cases into the future. It will not prevent them, he says. Admittedly, countries have managed to slow down the spread so as not to overburden the healthcare systems, and yes, effective drugs that save lives might soon be developed. But this pandemic is swift, and those drugs have to be developed, tested and marketed quickly. Much hope is put in vaccines, but they will take time. And with the unclear protective immunological response to infection, it is not certain that vaccines can be very effective. I mean, this is the Swedes are now saying that they are not really going to be exposed to any kind of second wave because something like 50% of their population now has had this without any mass testing, Martin. I mean, obviously, testing is important for those who are more vulnerable. There are various aspects of this that have been sort of coming out this week. One is the Nightingale hospitals, which were almost entirely empty. The same situation, by the way, in the United States, where all enormous medical facilities were created. There's one in London which actually had a maximum of only 20 patients in 4,000 intensive care beds. So, and the result has been that many, many people have been pushed out from healthcare that they would have been getting normally. But you first, Martin, can you address this whole issue of the preparedness of the NHS for an enormous pandemic that never actually arrived, and the suffering that's now going on because of that? Many people with getting routine doctor's visits, surgery, etc., and treatment from the NHS have not been getting it. Perhaps this is why more people have been dying.
Well, can I just, first of all, agree that we should have an inquiry into all of this. I think it's quite important that the government understands that there is going to be a public inquiry into this, just as there was into the Iraq war. And, of course, the Blair government resisted that, but ultimately they were forced to have one. It should be absolutely top of the agenda that we're going to go back over this.
I mean, Martin, and look at all of these decisions. Inquiries now, the terms of reference of them are set by ministers, not by judges.
I agree that there's a question about whether British inquiries are adequate, because the 2005 Inquiries Act, you know, it gives far too much power to the executive in creating the terms of the inquiry. But I think it's absolutely legitimate for mainstream politicians, you know, people who are in the political class, if you like, to be saying absolutely clearly that we're going to have a fully independent inquiry into every aspect of this, because, of course, there have been bad decisions at every stage, and probably some good decisions as well, which we should also look at what went well as what went badly. But I think the government of the day has got to understand that as they make their decisions, they are going to be held to account in the end for what they do.
Okay, but can you come back to the point, which is by the Swedish epidemiologist's point, Martin? The Swedish epidemiologist's point is that the real pandemic is invisible. It's been going on beneath the surface, and he says it's probably at its peak now in many European countries.
One of the problems we've got, Tony, is that it may be, unlike flu, people don't develop immunity through being exposed to it. It's not clear that they do.
Well, he said in Sweden they haven't had a single case of reinfection.
Well, that's okay. If that's the case, that's good. I mean, we can all breathe a sigh of relief. And that means that ultimately, quickly or slowly, the pandemic has to run through the population of the world, not just of Sweden. Think about countries like India and so on, and you'll see how potentially catastrophic this is going to be. The Swedish policy, we will see in the long run, when we look back, who made the right decisions and who didn't make the right decisions. Places like New Zealand and Kerala, which have done very well, have completely wiped out the virus, certainly didn't pursue a Swedish-style policy.
No, they didn't. Cape Cod Hospital also is closed without seeing any coronavirus patients at all. These are the emergency hospitals that have been opened, James.
Yes, I mean, at the time, I think we were all very supportive of them because it felt like they were very much going to be in use. What I worry about is the knock-on effects that COVID has had on other aspects of the public's health. So we've seen a drop in hospital admissions, in A&E admissions, people going to see their GP, and that will ultimately, from a physical and mental health point of view, have a huge effect on the nation's health outside of COVID. So I don't know how possible this would have been, but what I would have liked to have seen is these Nightingale hospitals, could even use it better now. Those with or suspect of the symptoms of COVID-19 being directed towards these centres, so they can be properly treated and properly monitored and properly sort of tested and all the rest of it there, so that people can still have confidence that they can go and visit their GP and, you know, with whatever health ailment they may have, or they can go to A&E if they need to go to A&E, and they can go to hospital for those appointments that have been booked, and have the confidence that they're not going to pick up COVID because there won't be any trace of it there. I mean, that for me would be an ideal situation. How possible that is to implement is another question. But I think it's unfortunate that these hospitals that were so lauded as, you know, this is the nation getting its act together, this is us showing that we can do what other countries can do and build a hospital in 9 days, to then not use them and have this mass resource just sort of sat there, I think is a bit of a wasted opportunity given the circumstances.
Well, Martin, just coming back to you about Sweden, David Davis has pointed out, the Tory MP, he's saying it's a bigger issue than Professor Ferguson's private life, which is one of the reasons that he was sacked. I mean, he's the scientist behind the lockdown from Imperial College. David Davis says is the accuracy of his model. How accurate is his model? David Davis says, when applied to the Swedish policy, the Ferguson Imperial College model forecasts 40,000 deaths by now. It's actually over 15 times what the real amount of, has been with their soft lockdown. So, I mean, there was an opportunity given to the British as well to have a soft lockdown. That is to say, to find the most vulnerable people, for them to lock down, and for younger, less vulnerable people, children, for example, to catch this. He's saying the actual, it's 15 times the real number were predicted by Ferguson to what actually happened in Sweden. So his models don't seem to be really very much use.
Well, I think that's where an inquiry comes in, Tony. We look at every aspect of this, the political response and the scientific response. Was it correct? Was it not correct? I think that's the real test. And of course, what's actually happened in Norway and Finland is they've had much lower deaths than in Sweden. And they are comparable countries. Don't forget, Sweden is not, like Britain, a major hub for transport. Yeah, we've got people flying through Heathrow, going everywhere. And, you know, we're much more exposed to the outside world. We're global Britain. Sweden, New Zealand, Kerala, and other countries which have done rather better than we have, don't forget, they don't get quite as much traffic as we do. But what we could have done, and should have done probably, is shut down in people coming into the country, or at least make sure we tested them and put them into quarantine. But we didn't do that.
Another COVID-19 related story. We just hear this morning that the Royal Mail's chief executive, Rico Black, has been sacked. Well, I mean, he's probably say he's resigned from the Royal Mail. I saw on YouTube this morning pictures of Royal Mail staff in sorting offices cheering, shouting and jumping around and dancing that Rico Black has finally been sacked. But, I mean, this is as a result of apparently the post office have just failed to react well to this. In other words, that there's a lot more reliance on stuff going by mail order because, you know, obviously many retail outlets have closed. But James, apparently the Royal Mail has not really taken advantage of this within the rules that it's allowed to, using social distancing at post offices. I've been into post offices myself, but that he has decided that they should have much limited hours. That means that they sometimes have to close with big queues outside, and now he's gone. Rico Black is no more chief executive of Royal Mail.
Well, without knowing too much about the situation, I think, you know, the Royal Mail does have an important role to play within the general COVID response, because as you absolutely rightly say, a lot more people who are still buying and sort of using the economy will be doing that over postage. And it's absolutely necessary for them to have, for them to do that. But as I say, without knowing too much about the situation, it's really hard to comment.
Well, you can. I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll post up a link to the video of the sorting office workers cheering and shouting. But Martin, this is a sort of company which is floated towards the private sector by, I believe it was the last Labour government, and just simply haven't done it. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
Well, I mean, it was. I'm afraid it was our Liberal Democrat colleague. What's his name now?
Vince Cable.
Against the advice of the Communication Workers Union. Well, obviously, one of the problems with moving to a kind of postal-based economy, which is effectively what's happened, is that in the warehouses and sorting offices, they're potentially COVID traps. And that means, of course, the packaging could be carrying COVID. So we've shifted from, you know, physical shopping to online shopping, but that then means that people, you know, people working in meat packing facilities all over the world, they are basically, you know, they are slaughterhouses. But if you don't have adequate social distancing in those slaughterhouses, then they are going to be spreading the disease that is going to be delivered to your door.
Okay, I mean, I do know a little bit about what's been going on in the Royal Mail, and they're very scrupulous. They have regular washing, they have gloves and all that sort of thing. So, and the World Health Organization has said that this is a month or so ago, that with these basic measures in the postal system, that you can't catch the virus from a package, because if you have a few basic ideas, like obviously, you know, the social distancing going on within the sorting office and wearing of gloves, all that sort of thing, the idea is that a letter takes a couple of days anyway to go from A to B, and as it goes through the system, with these measures in place, it should never be a route of transmission. And that is what the post office has been doing. But the main point here, really, Martin, is that the restriction on the hours and all these sorts of things that's been going on in the post office has meant that the chief executive has been sacked.
Well, presumably because the shareholders are losing money, if that's the reason he's been sacked. I mean, incidentally, of course, the post office has to compete against the private sector. Are they pursuing the same stringent standards as the post office? Because if they're not, then the whole thing's a waste of time anyway, because people are going to pay for cheaper delivery from eBay or whatever. And are they going to be doing all of this? This is the problem with having a fragmented, privatized economy. You haven't got the capacity to make overall plans, which, of course, we did have during World War II and in the subsequent years, but we gradually, over the decades, got rid of it. And then, of course, something like this comes along and reminds you why our grandparents in the 1940s weren't entirely stupid to nationalise an awful big section of the economy.
OK, so we're going to have a listen now to go over to the United States. We were talking there about effectively white elephant hospitals that were created for the pandemic wave of very sick patients that didn't actually come. Well, obviously, lots of people have died, nowhere near as many as predicted. But here's a New York City doctor who claims that COVID-19 is not what they say. He says that he's been working on patients and literally at the front line, and he is not actually seeing the symptoms that we're being told are the symptoms. And this is, I suppose, part of this whole idea of it's being a novel coronavirus. It's not a normal common cold. It does very different things to the body. So let's have a listen to him now.
This is Dr. Cameron Kyle Seidel, ER and critical care doctor from New York City. 9 days ago, I opened an intensive care unit to care for the sickest COVID-positive patients in the city. In these 9 days, I have seen things I have never seen before. In treating these patients, I have witnessed medical phenomena that just don't make sense in the context of treating a disease that is supposed to be a viral pneumonia. 9 days ago, I presumed I was opening an intensive care unit to treat patients with a virus causing a pneumonia that was ravaging lungs across the world, starting out as something mild, a cough, a sore throat, and progressively increasing in severity until ultimately ending in something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. This is the paradigm that every hospital in the country is working under. This is the disease, ARDS, that every hospital is preparing to treat. And this is the disease, ARDS, for which in the next 2 to 6 weeks, 100,000 Americans might be put on a ventilator. And yet, everything I've seen in the last 9 days, all the things that just don't make sense, the patients I'm seeing in front of me, the lungs I'm trying to improve, have led me to believe that COVID-19 is not this disease, and that we are operating under a medical paradigm that is untrue. In short, I believe we are treating the wrong disease, and I fear that this misguided treatment will lead to a tremendous amount of harm to a great number of people in a very short time. As New York City appears to be about 10 days ahead of the country, I feel compelled to get this information out. COVID-19 lung disease, as far as I can see, is not a pneumonia and should not be treated as one. Rather, it appears as some kind of viral-induced disease, most resembling high-altitude sickness. It is as if tens of thousands of my fellow New Yorkers are on a plane at 30,000 feet and the cabin pressure is slowly being let out. These patients are slowly being starved of oxygen. I have seen patients dependent on oxygen take off their oxygen and quickly progress through a state of anxiety and emotional distress and eventually get blue in the face. And while they look like patients absolutely on the brink of death, they do not look like patients dying of pneumonia. I have never been a mountain climber, and I do not know the conditions at base camp below the highest peaks in the world, but I suspect that the patients I'm seeing in front of me look most like as if a person was dropped off on the top of Mount Everest without time to acclimate. I don't know the final answer of this disease, but I'm quite sure that a ventilator is not it. That is not to say that we don't need ventilators. We absolutely need them. They are the only way at this time that we are able to give a little more oxygen to patients who need it. But when we treat people with ARDS, we typically use ventilators to treat what's called respiratory failure. That is, we use the ventilator to do the work that the patient's muscles can no longer do because they're too tired to do it. These patients' muscles work fine. I fear that if we're using a false paradigm to treat a new disease, that the method that we program the ventilator, one based on a notion of respiratory failure as opposed to oxygen failure, that this method, and there are a great many number of methods we can use with the ventilator, but this method being widely adopted at this very moment in every hospital in the country, which aims to increase pressure on the lungs in order to open them up, is actually doing more harm than good, and that the pressure we are providing to lungs, we may be providing to lungs that cannot stand it, that cannot take it, and that the ARDS that we are seeing, that the whole world is seeing, may be nothing more than lung injury caused by the ventilator. Now, I don't know the final answer to this disease. I do sense that we will have to use ventilators. We will have to use a great many number of ventilators, and we need a great many number of ventilators, but I sense that we can use them in a much safer way. And a much safer method. That safer method challenges long-held dogmatic beliefs within the medical community and among lung specialists, which will not be easy to overcome. But I really believe that they must be overcome. There are hundreds of thousands of lungs in this country at risk, and the time to overcome them is now. I'm confident that if those of us that work bedside with these patients, those of us who are witnessing the things that we have never seen before, despite the many years we have worked and the thousands of patients and diseases we have seen, if we can effectively communicate this to all those that are so important but who are not bedside, the researchers, the administrators, those who procure our resources and make our protocols, the politicians, our own governments, if we are able to convince them that this is a disease that is different than anything we have ever seen, I am confident that an answer can be found, that effective treatments can be discovered, and that a plan to disseminate that treatment can be rapidly deployed, and that tens of thousands and probably hundreds of thousands of lives and lungs will be protected. The time for this is now. We are staring into a future in which a great many of our fellow Americans are going to suffer, not to mention people all around the world. For those of who will not suffer directly from this disease, from the terrible human cost of this disease, for those who will not lose a family member or a friend, and there will be a great many number of people who will lose those close to them, but for those who don't, they are still going to suffer from the great economic cost of COVID-19. We are all involved in this future. So I urge you, for those of us, if you are out there, for those who work bedside, I urge you to speak up. We can change this. I thank you all for listening. Please spread the message and stay safe.
Now, I suppose I should apologize. That is quite a long clip, but I just thought the guy is so articulate, really. And it's almost like, you know, every now and again, you need to hear from the coalface. So that was Cameron Colford, medical doctor from New York. James, I suppose the main thing he's saying there is that because of this being a very new type of virus, the prescribed treatment for patients isn't necessarily working. He even goes so far as to say that ventilators could be injuring people.
I think he raises a number of important points, that it is an evolving disease. This is a evolving situation, which is new. We don't know a lot about it. Our understanding of it, and I think science's understanding of it, is changing day by day as we are more exposed to it. And also the way that it presents differently in different people. There aren't a subscribed list of definite symptoms. Some people get one of them, some people get two of them, some people get both, some people get neither. So I think what he's saying is an important addition to the debate, but we need to look at it around the what I like to think of as the consensus context, and the decisions, particularly public health decisions, public policy decisions, cannot be made based on just one person's view on the field. As valuable as that view is, and important as that view is to the debate, and it is vital, I think, that his comments and his observations are looked at importantly. But I think the best thing to do to keep people safe from the government's point of view is ensure that people trust the scientific advice. And that the decisions that they are making is based on scientific advice, not political reasons.
Okay, so the medical scientific advice is one thing, but I mean, we've had Professor Ferguson actually removed because it didn't look as if he even trusted his own lockdown advice, the scientific advice that he gave the government.
Yeah, I mean, the Professor Ferguson case, I don't really care what happens in his private life, but when you go on national television and say, for your own public health, do not do this, and then are caught doing that, it does undermine trust in the scientific, within the medical evidence. And I think that's absolutely what the government should be trying to avoid at all costs, because the moment that we start thinking, actually, we can't trust the scientists who are supposed to be advising the government on what to do next, given the unprecedented situation that they're in, and that there are so many unknown factors at play. The moment we do that, then anything's possible.
Okay, so I think, Martin, can we just hear from Martin now? What do you make of this whole idea that from the top, this Dr. Cameron Colford in New York is saying he thinks that there may have been a basic misdiagnosis here, that people are kind of going with what they were expecting to find, not what he is seeing as the disease is actually producing in people. I know a few weeks ago you mentioned this whole idea of a cytokine storm, I think it is, was going on in the lungs, where the immune system was over-responding, and this is not the same as pneumonia.
No, it's not. I think a lot of the problems have come because everybody's presumed that this is just a form of flu, and it's increasingly clear that perhaps it isn't, and that there may be people who recover, for example, there are long-term damages to internal organs. And of course, they've now discovered that some children are showing these very rare forms of pathology, which seems to be linked to COVID infection, which have nothing to do with lungs. And incidentally, I was in a park some weeks ago and I saw a young woman in her 20s taken away by ambulance staff, and she was basically fainting, but she wasn't, she was breathing perfectly normally. And I think this is the problem, is that people who are breathing normally, they're still having, it's basically like altitude sickness, as the doctor suggested. And she was saying to the staff as they were taking her away, why have you got this thing stuck in my arm? And they're saying, well, we're just checking your oxygen level, because she was conscious and she was talking and she wasn't having trouble breathing. That's just anecdotal. I think the real take home for me of this is, because we don't know what it is, we should err on the side of caution when it comes to things like releasing lockdowns. I think the decision to release the lockdown in England on Sunday was wrong. And I think time will show that it was the wrong decision.
What they're doing in Wales, and we'll be hearing about that in a minute. But let's start with listening to Prime Minister's questions, where the new Labour leader, Keir Starmer, tackles Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, on care homes.
The Prime Minister says that solving the problem in care homes is crucial, but that can only happen if the numbers are understood. And therefore I was disappointed that the Prime Minister doesn't have an answer to the pretty obvious question as to what are those 10,000 unexplained deaths. Mr. Speaker, yesterday the overall figures given by the government at a press conference for those that have died from COVID-19 was 32,692, each one a tragedy. For many weeks, the government has compared the UK number against other countries. Last week, I showed the Prime Minister his own slide, showing that the UK now has the highest death total in Europe and second highest in the world. A version of this slide has been shown at the number 10 press conference every day since the 30th of March. That's 7 weeks. Yesterday, the government stopped publishing the international comparison, and the slide is gone. Why?
Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as he knows very well, the UK has been going through an unprecedented, once-in-a-century epidemic, and he seeks to make comparisons with other countries, which I'm advised are premature, because the correct and final way of making these comparisons will be when we have all the excess death totals for all the relevant countries. We do not yet have that data. Now, Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to try to pretend to the House that the figures, when they are finally confirmed, are anything other than stark and deeply, deeply horrifying. This has been an appalling epidemic. What I can tell the House is that we are getting those numbers down, the numbers of deaths are coming down, the numbers of hospital admissions are coming down. Thanks to the hard work of the British people in reducing the R, Mr. Speaker, and reducing those numbers of fatalities, we are now in a position to make some small, modest steps to begin to come out of some of the very restrictive measures that we've had. I think people do understand what we're trying to do as a country, and as for the international comparisons that he seeks to draw now, I think he will have to contain his impatience.
So that's Boris Johnson, but he doesn't seem to have got the main point for some reason, which is that these figures don't really mean anything unless you compare them to population. I don't quite know why he didn't say that. Anyway, I mean, the figures around, looking at worldometers.info, they have a very good, I'll put a link up to this on our show page too, to the deaths per million of population. So for example, in the United States, they've got one of the highest, which is, highest totals, but not the highest per head of population. These things have lots and lots of things, like the density of the population makes a big difference. But the UK's figure is hovering around 500. Italy is higher at 520 per million, and Spain is higher too at nearly 600 per million. So anyway, these particular figures, James, Britain being the top of Europe, apparently, in the number of actual deaths. Would you agree that there's been a sort of a misuse of statistics in a way? Because it doesn't make sense to talk about a number only really as an average or percentage of the population.
Yeah, I think Keir Starmer kind of pretty much hit the nail on the head there. And it was, you know, quite interesting to see Johnson really deflect from this idea that we shouldn't be comparing ourselves with other countries. Obviously, you know, the main figure is in some cases, I think, less meaningful than when you compare it to per population. So how many deaths per 100,000, for example, or per million. Making sure that we are comparing ourselves to other countries and saying, okay, what are they doing wrong? What are they doing differently? And also, where are they in their sort of cycle with this? How far behind are we or ahead of we, and what lessons can we learn? I think Johnson knows that the figures don't look brilliantly for him, and they show that we have not handled this as well as other countries. Yes, our country is different because, as Martin said earlier, we are much more of an international hub than many of these countries, and we do have, I think, in some cases, much more complex needs as a nation. But Mr. Starmer pointed out, it doesn't look good that he's all of a sudden now hiding these statistics, hiding these comparisons, not in the interest of public health and public awareness, but to save face politically.
Yeah. Martin, I suppose you'd agree with that. The statistics, though, I guess we can look at these statistics right now, but we've got really no idea how accurate they are, because, for example, some countries are doing a lot more testing, and obviously we'll find a lot more cases.
Well, that's right, and I think the most, and of course I agree that the obvious point to make to Johnson is you were putting these comparisons up every day, and now suddenly you've decided you don't want to. Why? I mean, if it was good last week, why don't you want to do it today? And of course, the obvious answer is because it looks bad. And of course, what's actually happening is a lot of policy, we suspect, is being run by the PR people, not by the medical people. And of course, if an inquiry will look into that and say, hang on a minute, the decisions you made there were for your own PR benefit.
Well, I would guess that some of those PR people will be nowhere to be seen. They'd have disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah, but the point is that that's the point of political accountability. If the government decides to go with PR rather than scientific advice, then they should be held, their feet should be held to the fire for that.
Absolutely.
That's the minimum we demand of a competent government.
James?
No, I absolutely agree. We at the Lib Dems not only have been calling for this inquiry, which PMQs a few weeks ago, which Dominic Raab said wasn't going to happen, but we have been consistently saying, well, when you have these, whether it be for the easing of lockdown, whether it be for sending kids back to school, show us the evidence. If you want us to cooperate with these decisions that you're making, we have to have trust in you that you're making them for our benefit and not for your benefit, not for the benefit, as you say, of PR people saying, the public are getting a bit skittish about this. You need to take action.
Well, so if the government are going to block an inquiry, then it's up to us folks here in the press, the media, to do that inquiry, to preempt it, I suppose, and really to show the evidence that demands that such an inquiry has to take place. But I know one of the things which hasn't really been talked about much is the effects this is having on rents, both commercial and private rents. I mean, for example, many, many shops have been doing deals quietly to say to their landlords, well, we need a rent holiday. That means that we won't be paying rent at all for this period. And others are being told, well, OK, so you might have to pay it or you will have to pay it down the line. So this is incredibly important, but it's not really being discussed. I heard a really fascinating discussion on Irish radio about it this week. But what would you make about this, James Cox from the Lib Dems, your prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, because it's almost like it's become taboo. We see all these buildings that would usually command massive amounts of rent, and there's really nothing being said about whether rent's being paid. It obviously isn't on those properties at the moment.
Well, I'm still paying rent on my property in Bristol, so
for example, Cabot Circus, you know, what's going on behind the scenes there? Because almost all the shops are shut. Does that mean that the landlords are still demanding rent? I don't think it does. They will be making arrangements so that they can at least make sure that some of their properties, the shops are still there when the lockdown opens.
No, absolutely. There will be arrangements made, and also there is a whole insurance industry that's built around these sorts of crises, which whether it be for, we found out with, you know, with the pubs and with other sort of hospitality sector places, that if you cannot trade and you have this insurance, you can then claim back on that insurance.
Ah, but some of the insurance policies, James, will say, oh, well, if it's an act of God, you can't claim.
No, exactly. And there's been, I think, some people have been found short in this situation. And I think, you know, it's unacceptable that that some shops might be forced to completely close forever and some businesses might just disappear off the face of the earth. Because from my point of view, the economy should sort of just be on pause at the moment. Because when all this is over or we start to taper the lockdown properly and we start getting businesses up and going, we're going to need an economy there. We're going to need businesses and shops to get running. Otherwise, we are going to experience, if we're not already going to experience, one of the deepest recessions since the Great Depression. So it's not in the interest of landlords, whether it be for businesses or for private renters, to make sure that they go bust during this period.
No, definitely not. I mean, the thing is, particularly for retail properties, for most people have seen that the retail sector is on its last legs anyway. You know, shops desperate for customers, you know, doing with these amazing discounts. And hasn't the high street been kind of dying off anyway?
Yes, the high street has been in severe need of, a rebirth for quite a long time. And it's been in massive decline for ages because of, you know, some things within the control of the government, some things not within the control of the government. But there has been, I think, a massive public policy gap in support for the high street for a while. I hope this doesn't kill it off, because the high street is massively important, not just for local economies, but for things like well-being, things like people going, being able to go into shops these independent places that would not survive online, but survive because they're on the high street.
Okay. What about the private sector, though? Because this is another side of things. You know, people trying to pay their mortgages, people trying to pay their rent, and simply find that there's no money coming in now.
In private housing, or?
Yes.
Yes. So the mortgage holiday, I completely support. I think it was a very sensible idea, and the government, I think, needs to be much firmer with the banking sector to ensure that those requests are granted and that the sort of the period is honoured. My main concern, going back to landlords, is that this isn't filtering down to tenants. Tenants, like myself, are still paying rent, despite the fact that there is a whole new system in place where if you own a property, you have a mortgage, you can, during this period, which I hope will be extended, you can get a bit of a holiday from it. There isn't that in place for the rented sector at the moment. So a lot of people are going to be ending up in rent arrears during this period, which means that there isn't going to be a blanket sort of policy. It's going to be dependent on...
What does the Bristol West MP, the Labour MP, Thangam Debonair, had to say about this? And do you think, you know, she's on the case there?
Well, she's come under a bit of criticism because she's also now the Shadow Housing Secretary for Labour. And she came up with her 5 proposals for dealing with rent during this period. And I think 4 of those proposals are actually quite reasonable. Things about, you know, extending the ban on evictions, lifting the cap on local housing benefits, the local housing allowance as part of universal credit. Those things are very good. But on her policy on basically saying to renters, if you fall into arrears, you have 2 years of arrears to pay it back, which means that, say, if you're a part of this period, you're not paying rent, you can't pay rent for 6 months because either your furlough doesn't cover it or you're self-employed, and your housing benefit doesn't cover your rent, then you are, in my mind, you're giving people a debt bomb. You're saying you will now have to, once all this returns to normality, you're going to be paying not just your rent, but also the 6 months that you lost on top of that for a period of up to 2 years. And then what happens after that 2 years if you still haven't paid it off? So I'm very disappointed that Labour haven't taken this opportunity to, I think, be a bit more radical with the way that we look at not only housing in this country, but also welfare. They've rejected the idea of a universal basic income, which I think would fill a lot of the holes that have been... that are currently being shown up within our welfare system. But they've completely missed the mark on this proposal.
Martin Summers from the Labour Party. This doesn't seem really quite right, does it? Giving a rent holiday to people with mortgages and yet not doing the same for the renters because, as James is saying, many of them are living on the edge financially anyway. The idea that they will be storing up this massive amount of debt during this lockdown to be paid back in the future seems a little bit unrealistic and not very Labour.
Well, I have to agree. I think also the point about universal basic income is a good one. We should, after the 2008 crisis, have brought in a universal basic income. We didn't. And we're now paying the price for not doing it. But I seem to remember it was a Lib Dem Conservative coalition that was in power at that time, and they didn't do it. They should have done it. They wouldn't have done it because, of course, the Tories don't believe in it. Ultimately, the economic questions underlying all of this are going to be very, very powerful. We're not just talking about tweaking, about rents and things like that. There is probably going to be a banking collapse in the derivatives, stemming from the derivatives market further down the line here. What are we going to do when there's a banking collapse?
I mean,
I don't want to hear from the civil servants that we haven't got a plan.
Getting back to the point about Thangam Debonair, surely it's unrealistic of her to expect renters to be able to pay back the rent for this, whatever it is, 3, 4, 5, 6 months even, maybe, after the event. I mean, that's just not going to happen, surely, if people are on reduced incomes and possibly unemployed anyway.
Well, that's quite right. So, in other words, what's happening is people are still stuck in the past, BC, before COVID, and they're thinking in terms of the Overton window. If the audience knows what the Overton window is, the Overton window is what's acceptable mainstream politics. Now, of course, everybody has been caught short by this, so they're still playing the old thing. Oh, we must think about, we've got to think about, you know, how is this going to play in Middle England and all that sort of stuff. And in actual fact, what we really need is radical policies. And obviously the thing that we can unite around is a thing like something like universal basic income. I'm glad to hear that our Lib Dem colleague here is in favour of it. I'm in favour of it. The Green Party is in favour of it. Plaid Cymru are in favour of it. The SNP are in favour of it. And the only people who are against this are the Tories. And we've got to isolate them and we've got to bring it in.
Well, this whole idea of a ban on evictions is a good one too. Obviously, that maybe that should
absolutely
be kept for the whole of the rest of our lifetimes. But the problem there, Martin, is that you may get landlords who, at the end of all of this, they just want to sell their property. And so as soon as this ban on evictions is lifted, there will be thousands or tens or even hundreds of thousands of people evicted.
Well, what happened to me in the 2008 crisis is that my landlord, who had hundreds of properties in Bristol, went bust. Because he basically overreached himself as a buy-to-letter. And that meant that everybody who were his tenants were all evicted. And it wasn't to do with the landlord being a bad landlord. He just disappeared. And the various other people bought the debt. And eventually I was kicked out. I managed to resist for quite a long time. But loads of other people I know were kicked out straight away. And that is going to happen. And that, of course, is then going to put people on the streets where they won't have an address, where they can't register to vote, and all the rest of it. There is going to be a massive economic recession. That is absolutely clear. And we're going to require radical policies to get out.
James Cox, because you are the prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair is the sitting Labour MP and also Shadow Housing Minister. Do you think she's really thought this through? Because from what Martin's saying, you know, we could get an absolute avalanche of disaster as soon as this anti-eviction policy is lifted.
No, I think this policy hasn't been constructed, I think, with the tenants, whether it be in social housing or private housing, in mind as the how do we protect them. I think this is part of what I'm assuming is Labour's ultimate shift towards some form of electability, where they feel that they need to get back those Tory votes that they lost in the Red Wall and in the last general election. So it seems to be constructed more of, well, how do we protect landlords, not how do we protect tenants. Getting rid of but just going to your point on sort of, you know, what is acceptable. I think I give a bit of credit to the Tories here. They have pushed the boat out much further in terms of financial support packages than I think any of us ever thought they would. So there are things that I think they could do, such as lifting the cap on the housing allowance, having an unlimited amount so that if you are, as part of universal credit, once you qualify for universal credit, all of your rent is covered, no matter what property you happen to be living in. That doesn't feel like much of a radical policy now because of how much support the Conservatives have given to those who are on mortgages, businesses up and down the country, that sort of thing.
Well, we'd soon have Daily Mail headlines then, wouldn't we, with the family with 20 children living in a castle on benefits. That will all start up again, won't it?
Yes, but I think, you know, a compassionate government can't govern by listening to the Daily Mail. It's got to do what is right for the, you know, the vast majority of people.
And if let's move on to just talk a little bit more about the lockdown and the way that Wales is now in a different kind of legal situation to we are here, which is just over the Severn Bridge. Suddenly you've got a different regime. I saw that there are a whole bunch of I think it was people, paragliders that come over to Wales from the West Midlands, and they were fined for going over there. So we've got a different system in Britain, in England, than we have in Wales. So let's have a listen to the Prime Minister's questions clip and the question about that now.
We go down to Wales to Dr. Jamie Wallace. Dr. Jamie Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I congratulate the Prime Minister on being straight with the British people and spelling out a clear and cautious roadmap to lift the lockdown measures in England. Unfortunately, for my constituents in Bridgend, the Welsh Government has not set out any such plan or vision. Does he agree with me that the people of Wales deserve a government that is honest and clear with them about the road ahead?
Prime Minister.
I thank my honourable friend very much, and I will agree with him that, you know, but whatever the defects of the Labour government in Wales, my experience is that actually we've been working very well together across all four nations. We'll continue to do so, and my honest view is all those who talk about confusion or mixed messages are grossly overstating the position. The common sense of the British people is shining through this argument. They can see where we want to go. They can see where we need to go.
Martin, it sounds like the Labour government in Wales are, there's, at least that was a Conservative MP there, saying that there needs to be more clarity. They've said that we don't want to go with the English plan to slowly release the lockdown, but they haven't said what they do want to do.
Well, that's because the situation isn't clear. And when the situation's clear, you've got to be honest with people. We're not in position to relieve the lockdown. The pressure to relieve the lockdown is coming from, for example, the estate agents who want to restart the housing market. That's why the Tories have changed the messaging. They could have stayed with the same messaging, but they chose not to.
James, what do you make of this different situation on the two different sides of the Severn Bridge?
Well, I don't necessarily have an issue with regional variations or national variations of lifting lockdown, because the situation is different in different parts of the United Kingdom. That's not what I think is the issue. The issue is that they're all looking at the same evidence, and Wales, the Welsh government, which is a Labour Lib Dem coalition there, is saying, well, you're trying to open, for example, the schools, whereas the Welsh Education Minister, the Liberal Democrat, Kirsty Williams, has said the situation hasn't changed enough for us to be able to send our kids back to school safely.
So it doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem to be that these decisions are being made based on the medical situation and the extent of the virus. It's more political, and you could even argue that the different attitude in Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales is basically is based not on medicine, but just on opposition to Boris.
I think anybody who is being seen to try and take political advantage of this is rightly being rebuffed by large swathes of the British public, because it is not the time to get political. It is the time to do what is fundamentally right in the protection of public health. And I think at the moment you've got Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland looking at the evidence going, and I think most rational people who would have watched, the daily briefings and will have watched the Prime Minister's presentation going, well, hang on, the situation hasn't improved enough for us to start shifting things. We can talk about having a roadmap. That's absolutely fine. I think actually it's beneficial to have a roadmap so people can see that there is going to be an end to this lockdown at some point. But the development that we've got here in England compared to the rest of the nations of the UK shows, for me, that these decisions are not being made in the interest of public health. They are being made in whatever political or PR interest, because they want Johnson to have been seen to, you know, be beating the virus, which is just not the way to approach the situation.
One of the groups which has been least, it seems, really thought about or talked about are the homeless over the last few years, but suddenly they are being cared for, they've been housed, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions too.
We now go over to Yorkshire to Julian Smith. Julian Smith.
Mr. Speaker, over 5,000 rough sleepers, 90% of the homeless population in the UK, are now in temporary accommodation as a result of action taken by the government at the start of this crisis. Will the Prime Minister commit to providing all funds necessary and all action needed to ensure that this positive dealing with the homelessness crisis can be made permanent and each of these individuals can be given a long-term home?
Minister.
Well, I thank my right honourable friend, and as he knows, it is this government's ambition to end rough sleeping by 2024, and it's great to see the progress that has been made, even in this very, very difficult time. As he says, 90% of rough sleepers are now in accommodation, or have been offered accommodation, Mr. Speaker, and we will be investing considerable sums to make sure that we build the housing and we address the social issues that tackle that problem for good.
Martin?
Well, I mean, obviously I agree that we should tackle the problem for good. It's just rather sad that it's taken a crisis like this to do what should have been done in the first place, because of course homelessness has increased massively in my lifetime as a result of the suspension of building council houses, the sale of council house stock, the sale of social housing stock, all policies which were totally wrong and have created a massive social problem which we should never have got into in the first place. But hopefully, once you start doing the right thing, you can carry on doing the right thing. And of course, that brings up bigger questions about the macroeconomic policy that the government's going to pursue, things like national debt, etc. I won't go down into the detail, but we'll just mention that one of the things that's happening is that private companies are being bailed out in secret so that we don't know who's getting what bailouts. Massive. I've sent you stuff about this week, Tony. And of course, also private companies are being brought in to do the testing and all the other stuff that's going on rather than local authorities. And I think that this government in particular is wedded to the free market ideology that's got us into this cul-de-sac. And that's a fundamental problem.
Okay. James Cox, Lib Dem, can you give us your, I mean, because this is just seem amazing, doesn't it? It takes something like this for us to actually deal with homelessness, something which has been there really since the Thatcher years.
Yes, it is quite astounding how once we start treating things like genuine emergencies, how quickly we can, at least for now, find sort of a temporary stopgap within them. I do actually want to give credit to the local council, which is a Labour run, for fantastic job they've done. I think it's 90% of rough sleepers are now off the street, which is absolutely brilliant. But this is, at the moment, only in times of crisis. And we do need to be thinking a lot more long term about how we can use this as an opportunity to end rough sleeping and homelessness in this country for good. I went to see Caring Bristol a few weeks before the lockdown started, and I asked them, you know, what is the one change in public policy that could really, really make a difference right now and immediately? And they said, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier about how to deal with the renters, lift the cap on the housing allowance as part of universal credit.
Nice to have these are the sorts of solutions which it seems that people with their financial interests have been pushing away. And maybe this will be the straw that breaks the camel's back, even though I don't know if it's quite analogous to talk about COVID-19 as a straw. But anyway, we saw this week at Prime Minister's Questions, our final clip is around the whole idea of green energy and whether that actually is going to play a part in all of this. So let's have a listen to that now.
We now go across to Ruth Edwards. Ruth Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Green investments generated the highest returns in the recovery from the 2008 financial crisis. As we restart our economy, will my right honourable friend commit to prioritising investment in low carbon infrastructure, such as the electric vehicle charge point network and renewable energy production, which will also help the UK meet its net zero target by 2050?
Prime Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and to encourage the take-up of electric vehicles, we are putting a further £1 billion into EV infrastructure across the country to prevent range anxiety for those who use EVs.
A reason I bring this clip in is because we've got this new film out from Michael Moore called The Planet of the Humans, which is really looking at this whole massive boom in green energy. As she says there, the highest returns for investors have come from this sector. The only problem is renewable energy isn't necessarily renewable. Much of the new energy plants, for example, are biomass, which can just simply be wood cut down from forests. And when it comes to, for example, having an electric car and charging it, well, that can come from any kind of power, including non-renewable energy like gas. Gas-fired power stations are the majority now in firing up the whole car electric charging system. So it's a bit of a convoluted way of getting to the point. But James Cox for the Lib Dems, is the idea that highest returns are coming from green energy, don't you think that there is an element of this which is a bit of a con, where some of this renewable energy, like wood, for example, is not renewable, and that an electric car isn't necessarily going to help if it's all fired by non-renewable energy?
Well, it's not a perfect situation, and I think we sometimes as environmentalists really damage ourselves by mistaking the good for the imperfect. Whereas, you know, if we're looking at, you have like for like a car run on petrol or diesel and a car run on battery power, electricity, even if that electricity further down the line is being powered by non-renewable resources, the emissions that it cuts is still significant. Now, if we can use this opportunity to restart our economy and to really, you know, build a more progressive, compassionate and greener society, then I think you can begin to look at things in a new way. And if the government's main focus of the economy is going to be, we need the highest amount of returns on our investments, then investing in green energy, investing in low carbon jobs is being shown to be the best way to do that. You know, when Lib Dems were in government, we created the Green Investment Bank, which as a result has quadrupled our renewable energy production in this country. But sadly, the government have since privatised that bank. So I think bringing that back into the public purse, so that it can really ensure that those investments that are going to have to be made to get our economy going and to make sure that we do have a green recovery, making sure that that money is being properly sent to the right projects, which,
Dems, I know, have published an article which is very critical of Michael Moore's latest film. And it does seem as if there is a certain inability to really take on some of the criticisms that have come across on this. I mean, as usual, Michael Moore is always stirring the pot in some new direction. But the idea that we're still looking for the highest return seems to be maybe the problem, even if it means cutting down forests in order to fire power stations.
Well, I think, you know, I haven't seen the Michael Moore documentary, so I couldn't comment on its accuracy. But it raises an interesting point that what we sometimes think of as a wholly renewable system, whilst we're building it, is not the case. And it's going to take, when you're completely revolutionising the way that a country is powered, it's going to take time to make sure you plug those holes. I think the criticism of it, of sort of highest investment, we could sit here and have a whole long debate. You know, I consider myself a green capitalist. I consider myself somebody who sees that the best way that we're going to be able to tackle the climate emergency is to sort of use capitalism almost against itself with the tools available. So we could have a whole long debate about whether or not that's the right thing. But right now, with this recovery, we're going to have a Tory government, and they are wedded to the free market in a much more rigorous way than most people are. So I think ensuring that they see the benefits from their point of view, which is, you know, more financially based, I think, than egalitarian based, then hopefully we all become a little bit better and we sort of win that battle together.
Martin, compromises may be being made here, mightn't they? So the idea is we want green energy, but we also want the highest return at the same time.
Well, I think I've read the critiques of Michael Moore's film by George Monbiot, for example, pointing out that hardly any Greens believe in biomass fuel.
Hang on. No, that's just not true. I mean, I know many that do. For example, eco-villages that have been set up around Europe, places I've visited that are all run on biomass. That is basically wood chips.
All right. I'm not going to argue with you. I think the bigger questions are, will the Tories do what's necessary to reboot the economy as we come out of this crisis? But I'm not sure we are going to come out of this crisis. The crisis has only just begun. There is going to be a further crisis in the financial services sector, and then the questions are really going to be asked about what our
priorities are. Okay, Martin, maybe you could just now say where you think we're heading, if you think we're going into further stages.
Well, what's going to happen now is there's going to be a collapse in the real economy all over the world. Let's just look at China. And then on the back of that, the derivatives market's going to blow up, as it did in 2008, and the banking system is going to collapse because we haven't got the resources to...
So what do you mean? We're talking here about the casino economy also going down.
Yes. I mean, basically, with the QE has gone to the Federal Reserve in the US has basically merged with the Treasury, and they're printing money, any amount of money, just to keep the financial services sector.
Because I can remember Merton King, the former governor of the Bank of England.
About what's going on in this country. Martin. In this country, Rishi Sunak is basically created a non-accountable mechanism for bailing out corporations which are in trouble, and we're not even allowed to know which corporations are being bailed out. And they definitely include BlackRock, which have been given the task in the United States, privatized from the Federal Reserve, which is in itself a private sector.
Funnily enough, BlackRock are majorly involved in green energy as well. But look, Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, after the 2008 crisis, said it was absolutely essential that the real economy is absolutely separated from the casino economy.
Well, that's exactly what hasn't happened since 2008. But the Federal Reserve was intervening in the repo market in the United States in September before COVID-19 appeared. Although, of course, the U.S. intelligence services had told the Israeli Defense Forces that there was a pandemic coming out of China in November, which is itself suspicious. There is going to be a major crash. And I expect the top civil servants in the Treasury here and elsewhere to be putting their thinking caps on. What are we going to do when the financial services system collapses? And if they haven't got a plan, I'm going to be extremely angry, because they've had a decade and a half to decide what they're
going to do. Well, alternatively, it might be the government that goes bankrupt and collapses, not the financial system.
Well, the individual countries, what's going to happen in local government here, because of what's happened with COVID, unless they come up with more money for local government, local authorities are going to go bankrupt, as they have in the United States. But the central government in the United States won't bail out local authorities. It's bailing out the financial services sector. And this is all going on while we're all talking about ventilators and so on. Behind the scenes, a massive transfer of wealth from the public to the private sector, which is essentially insolvent, is still going on. The banking system has always been insolvent since 2008. And everybody's presumed that it's all right. It wasn't all right. This is going to get worse. And
okay,
ultimately,
James,
we're going to have to change a lot of things.
Okay, James Cox, prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West. What do you make of Martin's, like, rather doom-laden scenario there, that actually we could be looking at something far worse down the line, with governments, maybe starting with local authorities, possibly even, governments themselves going bankrupt as part of the attempt to get out of this situation?
Well, Martin does paint a very, let's say not very hopeful picture, but I think a lot of it is based on actually quite grounded work. We didn't learn the lessons from 2008, particularly in the United States. There is still far too much of, as you say, the real economy and the casino economy being fed into each other. The legislation that was meant to happen to make sure there is separation never appeared, and quite a lot of that has also happened around here with Brexit and with sort of the economic cycle that we are supposed to. We are due a recession, and I do fear it's going to be a particularly bad and nasty recession. So if we count that as, well, that's now unavoidable, it's going to happen, we have to decide as a country what we're going to do to come out of it. And I think I am worried about local authority funding. Because huge, particularly around things like adult social care, because at the moment there isn't enough money for it. Given another year, there's going to be a huge black hole and huge deficits in debt within local authorities, unless the government start funding them properly. And unless the government sort of decides that it's not going, revert back to an austerity agenda, and it does have a more sort of Keynesian investment, driven recovery package.
Well, look, you mentioned Brexit there, and we're going to go and have a listen to, I've discovered another clip from Prime Minister's Questions. There have been pressure put on by the Germans this week saying, well, look, it's just not realistic to have this negotiation complete by the end of 2020. You're going to have to extend it. You're going to have to delay Brexit, the actual negotiations, the trade deal negotiations, quite a lot longer. And I know both of you, Martin and and you, James Cox, Martin from Labour and James Cox from the Lib Dems are Remainers. What do you make of this? So let's have a listen after we've heard this clip then from Prime Minister's questions this week about the idea that maybe this is the opportunity to delay the negotiations, delay the Brexit, and although we've actually come out of the institutions, the political institutions, we're still part of the, for example, European Court of Justice and other. In fact, we are in a kind of limbo now. It's rather like Norway or Switzerland, where we're part of the system, the European single market, etc., but we're not part of the political institutions that decide the system. So anyway, let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions. I'll hear from both of you after that.
Stuart Halsey, we go across. Stuart Halsey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Both COVID and Brexit is suppressing trade, damaging jobs and the economy. And while we hope as COVID ends, global trade will bounce back, there's no guarantee that will happen quickly. The Prime Minister, though, could mitigate some of this damage by seeking an extension to the Brexit transitional period. Can he explain to the House why he's been so negligent in not seeking that transitional extension now?
Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think one of the most remarkable things about, as I said actually to the Right Honourable Gentleman, one of the most remarkable things about this crisis has been the way the whole country has come together to deal with it. And there's been a spirit of unity and sharing that I don't think we've seen for a very, very long time. I think a lot of people in this country don't want to see the Brexit argument reopened. They want to see it settled. They want to see it done. And that's what this government intends to do.
Well, Tim, what do you think of that?
Well, I think the obvious common sense, if you're talking about British common sense thing to do, is to extend the transition period. That's what all of our European partners want, so that we can negotiate our way out. If we don't do that, and I don't think they are going to do that, we're going to crash out. And then we'll have to work out what part of the hell we're in is to do with COVID and what part of the hell we're in is to do with Brexit. But it's certainly not going to
happen. So you
think
it might be over to World Trade Organization?
Well, what's going to happen, Tony? I've been reading stuff this morning. It's going to cost for a single lorry to cross the channel with a mixed cargo. You need £100,000 worth of permissions. And that's just going to make that sort of transport.
I mean, that doesn't happen in most trade organisations.
You will see people line to get into the EU from Turkey into Greece. There is a massive queue of lorries every day. Hundreds of lorries queued up every day. It takes them days to get through. That's what's going to happen.
James Cox from the Lib Dems. Some people even saying that the COVID-19 crisis has been constructed in order to delay Brexit even further. But what do you make of the what you just heard at Prime Minister's questions there, the idea that maybe it's a good time to stretch it out?
Well, you know, I find the argument that we're trying to delay Brexit now, or frustrate Brexit, or whatever the argument is now that they've won the debate. We have left the European Union. We are no longer members of the European Union. What is up for debate now is, do we want to be part of the single market and the customs union? What sort of deal do we want? What sort of institutions do we still want to contribute to and be a part of? And I think personally, when the government's own models say that leaving the single market is going to create quite a significant suppression of trade, to then throw that onto the fire of what COVID-19 is doing and will continue to do to our economy, I think it's just a complete recipe for the disaster. Martin's correct. If you talk about British common sense, YouGov have shown that actually most people in Britain want this delay for the negotiations, because most people accept that, yes, we are leaving the European Union and these discussions have to happen about our future relationship, but they can't happen in the middle of a pandemic at a time when the new normal is still evolving and changing every day.
Can't they do these things on Zoom? I mean, that's what you and I have been doing, and on Skype and things like that.
It's not so much having the physical discussions and the negotiations. It's fundamentally on two things. One, I'd like to see us focusing our top civil servants on, the mechanism of government on the COVID crisis and sorting that. But secondly, we don't know what the world's going to look like in 6 months, a year, 2 years. And these are going to be hugely important negotiations that are going to have ramifications for decades and decades to come. Our relationship with our biggest single trading partner, and how much of an open door we have, how much we close that door, the friction that we create with our trade, the frustration that we make, and the suppression to that such a key part of our economy.
So would you be happy for a few years for Britain to be stuck in this sort of Norway, Switzerland style, where we're in the single market still, but we don't have any MEPs and we don't have a place at the European Council, this sort of thing? So we're out of the political institutions, but we're still in the legal institution, the European Court of Justice, for example.
Well, happy might be slightly overstating it, but I would be more content with continuing our situation, even potentially joining EFTA on a semi-permanent basis. I think would be a good outcome of the negotiations.
Could you just explain EFTA and what that is?
Sure. So EFTA is a collection of countries, including, I think, Norway, Switzerland, Liechtenstein and Iceland, which basically have a relationship with the EEA, which is, in a sense, the single market, where they have access to that, but they don't contribute to the political institutions of the European Union. So they don't, as you say, they don't have MEPs, but they do have different relationships with it. I've heard it been referred to as sort of, you know, it's the common market, as it's membership of the common market in sort of in layman's terms. But that wouldn't be as bad. You know, ultimately I want us to be a full member of the European Union, but that isn't on the table. But the main argument here isn't in any way to frustrate our leaving or so people don't get the Brexit they want, but it's just not the time right now. We are in the middle of a huge crisis, as I say, which is going to have enormous ramifications. We can't begin to make these decisions, I think, when we're dealing with one file already.
Okay, well finally this week we'll look at some research that we've done this week with a former physicist. He's now retired, living in Wales. From the Bristol University physics department. And he relates, his name is Dave Lawton. He was a physicist during the Cold War, and we'll be airing a full interview with him where he discusses some fascinating stuff going on here in Bristol with spies from the CIA trying to infiltrate his department at the university. Another fascinating thing we'll be having after in the second hour is looking at Klaus Fuchs, because he was the great nuclear spy that leaked the secrets of the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb to the Soviet Union, and he actually got his degree here at Bristol University, amazingly. What Dave was pointing out is that there was a lot of research done, and this has a big bearing on the pandemic and the ethnic minority angle on it, because he says here that West Indians were discovered in the 1970s at the university to be severely lacking in vitamin D, which is one of those vitamins which the body uses to fight diseases.
I know one thing, and they're coming out, they're saying that a lot of the ethnic communities and the West Indian communities are dying because, you know, they're not, because of deprivation and stuff like this. Well, that's not true. It's because of lack of vitamin D. This has been known for years. Even in Bristol, my GP, John, knew it. He did a tests on the West Indian community in St. Paul's and found that they were lacking vitamin D. And this was 1970.
So that's Dave Lawton there, speaking to us earlier this week. He's retired now. He was a physicist up at the university. But what do you make of that, Martin? But it's possible that there are these basic deficiencies that some communities have because your skin, the actual colour of your skin and the pigment has a relevance to how much vitamin D it produces. If you're in a temperate country, but you've got black skin, you're not producing enough vitamin D.
Well, that may be true, but I think and certainly research needs to be carried out in this, because there clearly has been a big difference in BME communities.
Well, this is another one for the inquiry, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's another one for the inquiry. Don't forget that if you BME, you're more likely to be a frontline worker on low pay because of the historical discriminations and so on. I'm pretty certain that it's going to be a complex answer, but it's pretty clear that from what's going on, that you know, there are people who are self-isolating at home in comfortable circumstances, and there are other people crowding onto tube trains. And that is the class analysis. That's the bottom line, isn't it? The haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and people with cars, of course, who are generally wealthier people, are in an advantage, aren't they? Anyway, what do you make, James, of our little research, bit of research from the 70s from Dave Lawton there?
I mean, it's something I hadn't really considered. It's very interesting to hear. Whilst you were doing that, I did quickly Google to see if there was anything else on it, and there was a doctor who wrote a letter to The Guardian that got published in April talking about this as well. So I think, you know, as Martin said, there isn't going to be a simple answer to this. But we have to accept the facts, I think, as they are presented to us, that there is a disproportionate amount of black and minority ethnic people who are dying of COVID-19, including those in the medical profession. Now, some of that, and I imagine quite a lot of that, as Martin said, will come down to the vast social disadvantage that, on average, more people in the BAME community have.
You're painting a picture here of basically white managers ordering black and minority ethnic people into the front line to fight the virus.
I don't know if I characterise it quite like that. But with what we are seeing is that those in higher levels of social deprivation aren't being able to deal with the lockdown, whether that be from a health point of view or a social point of view or things like education and well-being, they don't have the tools to deal with it in the way that, say, some middle-class people do. And because of the discrepancy between race and class that still persists in the UK, if you have my skin, I'm more likely to have gone to university, I'm more likely to be in a middle-class management job, et cetera, than if somebody from the black and minority ethnic community. So what I think is fascinating about COVID is that it is, whilst it is a completely tragic situation that we're in, it is unmasking, I think, a lot of the underlying social issues that have persisted for so long. And one of those, of course, is race in the UK. And it's, I think, a testament to how we do treat people of different races that we are seeing this. Now, there might be some biological reasoning behind it. I don't know. I haven't read the research, and I'm not in a position to make a comment there. It is interesting. But I hope the lessons that we learn from COVID, we do actually take action on, and we don't just sort of let them disappear with the virus.
Yes, a bit like the homelessness business too. Anyway, that was, you just heard there, that's the prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers will be back after this. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. from 1977. That was Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks and their song The Chain. Two different chains, really. One is the chain where you try and keep things going even despite terrible personal differences, which is what the song's about. And then, of course, there's the COVID-19 chain, trying to break that. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Trump says he's had enough of negotiating with China. What did Trump say? And does it matter? Also, the FBI released the names of a top Saudi intelligence official in Washington who helped the 9/11 hijackers while they were preparing to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. We all know about Bin Laden. He was Saudi. But is this the Saudi government caught in an act of war against the United States? Also, a nanotech vaccine for COVID-19. According to Whitney Webb, when it comes, what will be in the concoction injected into us? Will you let them inject you with it? If it's made by Bill Gates, DARPA and the Department of Defense, will it be safe? And also, we review two books, Jeffrey Robinson's Merger, How Organized Crime is Taking Over the World, as well as Christians Being Censored, James Perloff's Truth is a Lonely Warrior on YouTube, his book. And we hear from him about the idea of a major crisis being a Kissinger-esque push for world government and whether that might actually be a good idea. Also, his work on the end times prophecies. Perloff thinks we may be seeing a war in heaven going on, unfolding down here before our eyes. But we start, obviously, Martin, with Trump and his decision that he's had enough of negotiating with China. I mean, this hasn't really been reported much over here, but certainly in Iran and China itself, it's the top of the news.
Well, I mean, obviously, relations between the Chinese and the US are pretty poor and have been getting worse. And that's not going to have, you know, very good implications for the world economy. And, of course, it runs the risk of global war. And that's where we are.
So why has he decided to he doesn't want to negotiate anymore now?
Well, basically, what's happening is that the Trump faction within the US are trying to ramp up anti-China sentiment, because they hope on the back of that that Trump can be re-elected in November. So he's doing the best he can to blame the Chinese for the COVID outbreak. So we saw the Murdoch newspapers last week in Australia and elsewhere putting around this so-called leaked report, which pretty much looks as if it's just been cobbled together from the internet, which basically says that the virus comes from the Wuhan laboratory. But of course, the intelligence services themselves have briefed off the record saying that they didn't have anything to do with this report. So Trump is definitely he's pushing on an open door, because there's, you know, people are looking for somebody to blame for this, and from his point of view, it's what he's got to do. He's got to lay the blame on China.
Do you mean he's pushing an open door over in the White House?
Well, I mean, the White House is trying, and Pompeo and others are definitely trying to start. They're using China as a whipping boy to try and get re-elected. Now, ultimately, of course, they have to do some kind of deals with the Chinese one way or another. So in many senses, they're making their lives more difficult.
Well, this is not going to be very easy for Trump, is it? He got elected on the whole thing of no new wars.
Well, he didn't. He did and he didn't. And in actual fact, he's pretty much done what the Pentagon wanted anyway. And don't forget, the underlying policy of the US is to try and nobble China now before it gets to a point where it can't be nobbled. And that's obviously what may well be behind this whole crisis. The Chinese may be sitting on information that the source of the COVID outbreak is, in fact, possibly from the Wuhan Games or somewhere else. Fort Detrick in Maryland was closed down in the summer last year because of some kind of infraction. And what the Chinese are saying, well, tell us what happened in your biowarfare laboratory. And don't forget, the US has got biowarfare labs all over the world. There's one particularly controversial one in Georgia. There's some in Kazakhstan. And they've used biological warfare in the past against Cuba, against North Korea.
Anyway, look, bringing it back to this week, Martin, speaking in an interview with Fox Business Network broadcast on Thursday, Trump said he might even decide to sever diplomatic relationship between America and China. He's repeatedly accused China of failing to contain COVID-19.
Well, I mean, you can see what game he's playing. He's trying to get he's called his opponent Beijing Biden and so on. So that's the game they're playing. Now, that's internal US politics, but of course it has geopolitical implications. Now, if you really want to go to war with China, then you will end up going to war with China. But don't be surprised if you get a bloody nose.
Trump says they should never have let this happen, accusing the Chinese. So I made a great trade deal, and now I say this doesn't feel the same to me. The ink was barely dry and the plague came over, and it doesn't feel the same to me.
Well, in other words, there are elements within the deep state in the US who want to try and basically crash the Chinese economy and frustrate them from becoming a dominant power in the developing world over the next 20, 30 years. And if they don't do it now, it'll be too late. And that, when the history comes to be written, may be the explanation of everything that we're going through.
Trump says, right now, I don't want to speak to him, talking about President Xi.
Well, the Chinese will say, don't speak to us then. But when we get to a situation where you need our help, you can whistle for it.
Well, talking of which, Russia and China have slammed the U.S. plan to extend the U.N. arms embargo on Iran. I didn't realize that they're going to do that. That's what they've said.
Well, yes, but at the same time, the Russians and the Chinese are going to ignore them and carry on supplying weaponry to the Iranians. And, of course, a war could break out in the Gulf, which will bring in Russia and China versus America. And, of course, we've got a British frigate threatening Venezuela at the moment, and they seem to be implicated in this coup. That's what we're doing. And, of course, in Britain, we're all obsessing with the coronavirus crisis. We may be being dragged into war with Iran and China by our US and Israeli allies, and we'll just find ourselves in it without having even talked about it.
Also, a US Navy warship has been transiting between the Taiwan Strait and the China's People's Liberation Army starts live fire drills. I mean, this Taiwan Strait, how is that, you know, strategically important?
Well, I mean, if you were the Chinese, you would want to have a reasonable control of the access to your mainland, wouldn't you? I mean, that's pretty much what the Royal Navy's been for hundreds of years. And what basis does the US trail its coat around the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait? It's basically provocative, and the Chinese are going to respond as provoked. And, if you're going to do stuff like that, it only takes one mistake and one live fire incident, and you're off.
Now, the East China Sea is right next to that. I mean, Taiwan and China have got a long history, haven't they? Basically, Taiwan is a kind of U.S.-style country right just off the coast of China.
Well, what happened at the end of the Chinese Civil War in the 1940s is that Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists who'd lost on mainland China retreated to Taiwan, basically overwhelmed the local population who had been always living there, were basically taken over by a lot of mainlanders who were anti-communist nationalist Chinese, the Kuomintang. It was not a democratic country for many years. It's become more democratic in recent years, and the locals who've always lived there basically just want to be an independent country. But neither the Kuomintang faction nor the Chinese communists want to accept that, because they basically think that China and Taiwan are part of the same country. In practical terms, they're not, although in recent years there's been massive amounts of trade and transport links between the two sides. And what's quite interesting, of course, is that when the Taiwanese realized that there was a virus problem in Wuhan, they immediately stopped and checked everybody coming in from China. And quite a lot of people do cross that all the time. And they did it very effectively. And they've managed to control the virus in Taiwan, as they have done in China. It's only the British and the West that doesn't seem to be able to manage to do it.
Well, Iran and China are both, it seems, falling out with the US, but not just them. Obviously, the Russians too. And this hasn't really, I haven't seen any reporting of this, but the Russia is saying that although they're trying, the United States is not willing to extend the new START treaty. Now, this START treaty involves the nuclear weapons, doesn't it? I mean, this is something that the Russians are saying, well, we want to extend this new START treaty. America is saying no.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically what Trump's done is he's ripped up all the treaties that have been negotiated before he came to power. And you can do that, but then you've got to have an arms race. And if you're going to have an arms race, you've got to find the money for it. If you've got to find the money for it, then you've got to cut something else. So when we're talking about rebuilding the US economy, investment in infrastructure, that will all have to go down the drain because we've got to build more nuclear weapons.
Well, yeah, talking of which...
anymore. There's more than enough to destroy us all already.
Well, talking of which, antiwar.com are reporting that the world spent $73 billion on nuclear weapons last year, the US spending half of it.
Well, that's right. They're going to go back to the old policy of just ramping up nuclear spending in the hopes that they can bankrupt the Russians and the Chinese. Now, I think that won't work because the Chinese have only got a tenth of the nuclear warheads that the US has got. But the fact is they've got more than enough to wipe out the US. So they're not going to try and chase after it. The Russians have upgraded their nuclear forces so that they're able to hit anywhere in the world within half an hour. So they're not going to spend much more money on it. They've already reached what they want to reach. But in the US itself, there's this fantasy that the more you spend on nuclear weapons, the more powerful you become, even though in actual fact you can never use them without destroying yourself. It's silly, it's pointless, but that's what they're doing because that's how they are.
So nuclear threat, that's what they're basically saying. It's February, this new START treaty finishes. I suppose we could have a new president by then.
Well, we could. And it may be that Biden would be less belligerent than Trump, but I wouldn't count on it. The deep state in the US is a pretty permanent feature of the landscape. And they do not intend to cooperate with Russia and China. And
I mean, what do you make of the way that Bernie Sanders has been sort of elbowed out of the running?
Well, of course, and he was absolutely cheated of the nomination in 2016. And it's quite clear that it wasn't the Russians that cheated him of it. It was the Secret Services in the United States. And Biden has been pushed in to the Democrat nomination to keep Sanders out. Trump must have a reasonable chance against Biden because Biden's senile. But nevertheless, Trump is now thrashing around because what looked like a fairly easy election campaign for him is turning into a nightmare. And his reaction in those circumstances is to lash out, which is what he's been doing. It's very dangerous. I mean, his assassination of Soleimani in January, that, you know, you expect random events to kind of come along, like the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in 1914, but you don't expect the most powerful man in the world to be the terrorist. But there he was, outside international law, assassinating other people's top generals with no rules.
We haven't really been looking and thinking much about Syria, have we, which was always in the news in the run-up to the pandemic. But now... Hezbollah are saying that Israel sees Syria as an existential threat. There are regular acts of war by the Israelis against Syria. And I wonder, because a lot of this stuff seems to have been forgotten in the background of the pandemic, who are Hezbollah and why are they saying that Israel sees Syria as an existential threat?
Well, Hezbollah are part of the Lebanese democratically elected government. They've got a military wing which humiliated the Israeli Defense Forces when they last invaded Lebanon, and they're enemy number one as far as the US and the Israelis are concerned. That's why they are being targeted. But they are preparing to fight. They're preparing to fight. Everybody's preparing to fight.
But, I mean, they're a terrorist organization, aren't they?
No, they're a political organization with a military wing. You could say that Trump is just the political wing of the Pentagon, couldn't you? I mean, you can't, they're being called terrorists by Pompeo. They don't regard themselves as terrorists. They regard the US as terrorists. And since the US and the Saudis have been the major promoters of jihadi Salafist terrorism, Sunni terrorism, for over 30 years, they're not wrong. Our allies inside Syria are Al-Qaeda Syria. That's who the British Army are cooperating with. At the same time, of course, the Daily Mail and the Tory press over here continuously demonises Muslims. Meanwhile, our special forces are training the most extreme Muslims. You couldn't make it up, but it's true.
Okay, but I mean, another thing that's been going on, which has gotten virtually no coverage, as far as I've seen, is the attempted assassination of Hamdok in Sudan. He's one of the leading political figures there. Then there is massive protests going on in Sudan at the moment. How does Sudan fit into all the rest of these conflicts in the Middle East?
Well, the Sudanese army, some of them are fighting in Yemen in alliance with Saudi Arabia. That's a historical legacy of the closeness of the Sudanese military with the Saudis. But of course, the more democratic forces in Sudan aren't necessarily happy with that. I mean, why would you want to send your boys to die in Yemen? I think what's actually happening is all over the world, we're getting the acceleration of what were already very tense and difficult circumstances. And the UN Security Council was talking about the possibility of having a global ceasefire while everybody deals with COVID. But the US has shot that down. It was quite a long shot anyway, but it was actually going great gangbusters, really. Quite a lot of military groups around the world, like the ELN in Colombia, were saying that they were interested in getting into this idea of a global ceasefire. But the US wouldn't sign up to it unless everybody condemned the WHO and China as part of the resolution. And, of course, other countries weren't prepared to do that, so the whole thing fell. And in any case, the policy of the US seems to be, during this pandemic crisis, to use the crisis to try and nobble their enemies in Venezuela, as we've seen, in Iran and in China. Therefore, they're hell-bent, basically, on confrontation. And that's what we're going to get.
Well, we'll be talking about the amazing situation with the revelation by the FBI of a senior intelligence official working for the Saudi government in Washington who was aiding the 9/11 hijackers in a minute. But Martin, this whole situation is the backdrop of a real bit of a falling out going on between the Saudis and the United States. I suppose in the background of that, of course, is all this rising of tension between the US and China and the US and Russia and the US and Iran. But it seems that the relationship with Saudi Arabia is suffering, particularly over oil prices, as a result of other ship plates which are shifting amongst the superpowers, really. But what do you think is the situation now with Saudi Arabia? Because it's been a very key ally of the US for a long time, but the US seems to be cutting it adrift.
Well, I think pressure in the US is coming from the oil industry, the fracking industry. They see the Saudi attempt to get market share as threatening them. And basically, their attitude towards Saudi Arabia is that it's a client state and they should just do as they're told and, basically dial back on their policy of trying to get market share for their oil. The tensions have always been there. And they're coming to a head. So, for example, they've withdrawn the Patriot missiles, which were sent in supposedly to protect the Saudi oil industry from missile strikes from the Anasrullah movement in Yemen. If we didn't have the COVID crisis going on, we'd all be talking about the possibilities for World War III. But in actual fact, everybody's so, obsessed with the immediate threat that they've failed to notice that this, in actual fact, we're moving rapidly towards confrontation on a geopolitical level.
Yemen, apparently there are some peace talks going on there. The Yemeni forces yesterday retook strategic positions from the Saudi-led, so-called government. It's really a kind of Western-sponsored puppet government there. And back home in the U.S., protesters are demanding an end to the lockdown in front of the Minnesota governor's residence. There's a lot of this going on in the US now. They're basically saying, well, we understand the dangers of the virus, but the lockdown is not the solution. And at state capitals around the United States, and in this case in Minnesota, outside the governor's residence, people are just saying, well, look, and we're going to gather outside, we're going to have our protest. You've said that the rules mean we can't protest. Up yours.
Yeah, whether they're a majority or not, it doesn't really matter. They're going to do what they're going to do, and Trump is encouraging them. So on the one hand, Trump, when he speaks, you know, he obviously he's not a reliable person. He changes what he's saying from day to day. He thinks that by pushing for an end to the lockdown, he's going to help himself get re-elected. A lot of his financial backers are people who want to end the lockdown. They're people who own certain kinds of industries which are going to benefit in the short run from ending the lockdown. I think lockdown ending or not ending, the crisis in the financial sector is going to hit anyway, one way or another. And of course, if you unlock down and then you have to lock down again, you'll find everybody completely confused. And of course, in the United States, if there is a massive collapse, and just look at the unemployment figures, don't forget the unemployed in the United States, whatever their politics, are armed with automatic weapons.
Well, I don't think that's quite the case.
The Chinese population is disarmed, apart from the People's Liberation Army. The US population is not. So if you do find out, you know, you could be looking at shootouts between these militias and the police, or these militias and the army, or other, you know, and if it starts, you know, the potential, what we're going to see now is the social system in China is going to be tested to the limit, and the social system in the United States is going to be tested to the limit. And I think that the United States is more likely to crack.
Okay, interesting. Also, Biden has been saying that anyone who believes Tara Reid should not vote for him. Who is Tara Reid?
Well, it's one of his somebody who used to work for him, who claimed that he was basically touching her inappropriately and propositioning her and so on. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it certainly sounds plausible. And he's basically got a track record of doing stuff like that. He's really a rather unsuitable candidate. But that's American democracy for you.
Well, look, it's,
I
get back to this point we made about Bernie Sanders. How come the Democratic Party have chosen this guy who's got a really tainted record? He's very easy, really, for people to criticise, even within the Democratic Party. He's seen as one of the sort of elite oligarchy. There's this whole Hunter Biden scandal to do with him getting rid of the chief prosecutor in Ukraine in order to help an oil company that he was part of over in Ukraine. He just seems to be a walking disaster. I suppose it might be that he's more or roughly around the same level of walking disaster as Trump.
Well, I'd say that's pretty accurate. The problem is that the US political system is owned by the oligarchy. And nobody is allowed to get anywhere near a sniff of power unless they've already been absolutely compromised by that oligarchy. And in that sense, Biden is perfect from their point of view because he's one of them. He's in their pocket. He's got lots of dirty washing in the cupboard, which can be brought out to keep him in line. And if he wins, he will be a reliable backer of Wall Street and the Pentagon. And in actual fact, you can run third-party candidates in the US system, but because it's a first-past-the-post system like the one we've got, they've got no chance. And all that will happen if a third party, like Tulsi Gabbard, for example, could run as a third-party candidate, but all she'll do is take the votes from Biden and let Trump win. And that's why she's backed Biden, as has Sanders. But the system itself is the problem. I mean, there's lots of things wrong with the Chinese system as well. It's not, to say the least, that's not a democratic system. But it's also an effective system, whereas the US system is not a democratic system, and it's an ineffective system.
Well, Yahoo News broke the story earlier this week. The FBI named a name. That name is Mossad Ahmed al-Jarrah. He was working for the Saudi government at the Saudi embassy in Washington apparently something called the GID, which is the Saudi Secret Service, and he was helping the hijackers for the 9/11 attacks in 2001. This idea of the FBI mistakenly releasing his name. I mean, we know that these strategic leaks can happen, and I'd like to hear your opinion, Martin, on whether you think it's an accident this name has come out now or not, because there's a lot of tension going on with Saudi Arabia. But the way I understand these things work is, you know, you'll get the head of the FBI be told, right, we want to cause some trouble for the Saudis, so this name gets leaked, and then the head of the FBI will phone the journalist at Yahoo News and say, you want to look at these court papers, there might be something interesting in there. So they tip them off. And then, of course, it's going all around the world now. Mossad Ahmed al-Jarrah was a Saudi diplomat, Saudi government official helping the 9/11 attackers. Up till now, we've heard about bin Laden and the Saudi citizens, but it looks as if the Saudi government itself was actually involved in an act of war against the US.
Yeah, well, it may be, as you say, that the timing is to do with tensions between the Saudis and the US, but it's all to do with a lawsuit by victims of 9/11 families who've been trying to sue the Saudis, and they tried to get documents released, and the courts decided that it would threaten US national security to release the documents. This is why we're finding out about all of this, but by accident or not, this name has been allowed out. I have to say that although the mainstream theory is that there were 19 hijackers who hijacked these planes, lots of more informed people realize that the hijackers possibly didn't even get on the planes, and that the planes were flown by Global Hawk technology into the buildings and so on.
Hang on. I thought that there was CCTV of some of these hijackers getting on the planes in Boston.
No. That was before they got on the flight. That was when they were getting the link plane because they got on two planes to fly. Anyway, as you'll know, Tony, there's massive research that's gone on in the subsequent years into what actually happened, and we still don't know.
Well, there's a guy called David.
Story behind all of that is bunkum.
What I'll try and do is I'll try and get, because I know someone who's actually interviewed two of the guys who said that they were on the actual list of hijackers who never actually died. At least that's what they said.
The Daily Telegraph and the BBC interviewed people the following week and said, we're on this list, but we're still alive. Here we are. We can't be the hijackers. We're still alive, and here we are in Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Well, it might be as simple as that. They might be their name might be Martin Summers, and you know there might be more than one Martin Summers around.
Well, and it may also be that they basically created some false. What you've got to remember about these kind of psychological warfare operations is two things going on. One is the actual operation to blow up the buildings to create the effects that you want to do, the technical side. The other is to create a trail of fake evidence pointing in a certain direction. And I think you'll find that the Saudis, deep state, the Mukhabarat, will be cooperating with the CIA and MI6, who are also cooperating with Mossad, to create the whole illusion of the whole thing. And I'm quite sure that the US General Staff and the Chinese General Staff and the Iranian General Staff have got a pretty good idea of what happened. The Iranians, for example, uncovered the fact that everybody on the plane that crashed at Shanksville, however it crashed, everybody on that plane worked directly or indirectly for the Pentagon. Totally impossible.
I know, but you see, in that situation, it might be that those people were just under orders to get on that plane. The plane would land safely, they would get off, and the idea was to create a whole list of people on a flight, but actually there were no civilians on that flight.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, that's so there's all sorts of possibilities.
I mean, that's the implication. And of course, going back to 1964 and Operation Northwoods, what they planned to do there was have planes hijacked and crashed, but there wouldn't actually be any casualties. There'd just be a pretend casualty list. Now, if I was going to do something like that, I'd make sure there was a real casualty list. And, of course, there was a real casualty list in New York, but that was just random people who happened to be in the building. The world has never been the same since those attacks. As Blair said at the time, this changes everything. He was right, but in the wrong way. You can be sure that if people like us, with our limited resources, are aware of the massive holes in the official story, that other powers who've got far more resources than we have know an awful lot more than we do.
That, that an operation northwards from 64 you're talking about was penned by a guy called Leon Lemnitzer.
Yep.
Who was a Bilderberger as well as a top official at the Pentagon. Apparently, President Kennedy wasn't interested. He said, no, this is an operation too far. But the military seemed to be often pushing these things. And you need a very strong president, unlike Trump, maybe, to stop them doing it.
Yeah. And I think, you see, let's just have a thought experiment. If the viral attack in China was actually a military attack on China, there's no guarantee that Trump would be involved in knowing about it. So he then responds to stuff that he doesn't really know what's going on. I mean, Trump on the day of 9/11 itself said those buildings must have been bombed because they don't collapse like that. Don't forget, Trump is a real estate guy. He builds skyscrapers. And he's quite aware that skyscrapers don't collapse like that unless they've been bombed. He said that on the day. Giuliani, who's Trump's lawyer, he seems to be somebody who knew what was happening. Because he was the mayor of New York on that day. And he seemed to have some kind of knowledge about what was going on, whereas Trump doesn't. And that could explain why Trump is not well liked inside the deep state, because he isn't basically in the inner circle. But nevertheless, what we're dealing with here is truly evil and on a very big scale.
So also, Martin, I thought it would be worthwhile looking at some of the implications. I almost feel like doing a kind of weekly Bill Gates roundup, because there's so many articles coming out, fascinating insight, and some of it is being picked up from many years ago to do with Bill Gates and his vaccine program. Which quite clearly seems to be one of the things that's been driving, along with Bill Gates' amazing amounts of money, the policies they're reacting to the COVID-19. I'd just like to refer you to an article which is on Mint Press News, The Faux Generosity of the Super Wealthy, Why Bill Gates is a Menace to Society. And maybe at the end we'll play Chinny B's wonderful Menace to Society song from the 1990s at the end of the show. But if Gates represents a net negative force in world politics, why does he receive such good press? For starters, he makes sizable donations to a host of mainstream corporate media outlets. That's what the journalist Alan McLeod is saying on Mint Press News. Now, there's a lot of money that goes from both Microsoft and from the Gates Foundation to media. So this obviously is going to sort of sweeten the pill, if we could call it that, of the vaccine pill.
Well, I mean, Bill Gates has got a reputation in alternative circles as being the fount of all evil. And I'm pretty much opposed to his empire building myself. But he isn't, in many ways, he is the face of other people that we don't know who they are, who are pulling strings behind him. I think he's, what he does, of course, and this is what all billionaires do, is that they create these foundations for so-called philanthropy. And that means all the money that goes into the foundations is tax-free because it's for charity. And that means they can then use these foundations to push various political projects which are to the benefit of their non-charitable activities. So basically somebody who's a computer programmer has appointed himself as the world's expert on health matters, and he's the biggest funder now that the US state has withdrawn. He is the biggest funder of the World Health Organization. That cannot possibly be right.
The Gates Foundation, in this article, quotes, the Gates Foundation has spent 20 years relentlessly championing business solutions to inequality and poverty. Through this corporate approach, Mr. Gates personally and the Gates Foundation more generally have enhanced the power and clout of corporations at every level of decision making, regional, national and international. The Gates Foundation has helped make philanthropy a handmaiden to corporate power rather than helped to empower the non-profit sector, which can act as a check on corporate profiteering and abuses of power. So I'll put a link up to the article on our show page. But what do you think of that? The Gates Foundation actually, helping to squash the non-profit sector and doing a lot to help big corporations.
Well, what happens is they, because they're the money bags, the not-for-profit sector is basically being taken over by them. And they then present themselves as being, trying to benefit humanity and all the rest of it. And in actual fact, they've got their own agenda behind the scenes. Richard Branson, for example, helped to fund the concert for Venezuela, which was held just inside Venezuelan territory, which was a deliberate provocation to try and start a war between Venezuela and Colombia. And Branson, as a philanthropist, decided he was going to stick his finger into that. Now, of course, what may happen if we get a crash is that, in fact, you end up with a situation where Branson and Gates go bust. So, in actual fact, their money's paper money anyway. But they're all treated as if they are the world's leaders.
I might suggest that everyone else goes bust and they're the only two left standing. But look,
well,
Martin,
that may be the case.
Martin, one example, he says, of the foundation enhancing corporate power of Gates is the close relationship with the pharmaceutical and chemical giant Monsanto, who the Gates Foundation helped to gain a strong foothold in Africa and oversaw a flawed clinical trial of the HPV vaccine in India in 2009, where 23,000 impoverished girls aged 9 to 15 were exposed to lethal drugs without even their parents' consent, leading to 7 deaths. He is also preoccupied with controlling Africa's population through family planning during a population boom. Gates is also one of the most important individuals, and maybe we can finish looking at this article on this note, and it's some education, which I know you were working in, and your father, leading the assault on the American Public Education Network in the form of charter schools, effectively privatised the public school system in the US, where the public continue to foot the bill for the school but have no influence on how it's run.
Well, it's pretty much like the academy system here. I mean, when I was a kid, all schools were run by the local authorities and were answerable to the local authorities who were elected by the people. That's no longer the case in this country, and it's no longer the case in the US. Taxpayers' money is basically channeled to private organisations who make, if they don't make a direct profit from it, what happens in academy chains here. I noticed that the Oasis Academy chain here, which I used to work for, are keen to go back to work on June the 1st, or at least their bosses are. But I'm not quite sure that the teachers are. And there's no accountability. The public money to deal with the crisis has been farmed out to Boots, for example, are going to run the testing regime. Not the NHS, Boots. Boots, a profit-making company.
Also, looking at Gates, before we finish with him, I mean, there is Whitney Webb has penned this quite interesting article looking at the idea of a nanotech vaccine, and that there's quite a lot of these companies that produce vaccines, a lot of work that they've been doing over the years that they haven't shared with the rest of us. And it may be that one of the reasons they're quite confident in having a vaccine is because they've got quite a lot of technology out there which is hidden, but which is actually to do with vaccines that operate in a different way to, say, something as simple as maybe the hepatitis vaccine or things like the smallpox vaccine, which was one of the original ones.
Well, I sent you an article this week from the Nigerian press where the opposition in Nigeria have accused the government in Nigeria, which is a pro-Western government. The guy used to be a military general who runs it, and he used to run Nigeria as a military dictatorship. And the Gates Foundation have been lobbying. They've given a massive bribe to the existing government to make COVID-19 vaccines compulsory in Nigeria. And as the opposition in Nigeria said, there isn't even a vaccine yet, so we certainly don't need to pass legislation to make it compulsory to be vaccinated. Now, this is all very suspicious. At some point, they may just come forward and say, oh, here it is, the vaccine, and it's got to be compulsory. And they're already lobbying for it to be compulsory in Nigeria. And they've given a massive bribe. I can't remember. It was several million dollars to the existing government to pass this legislation. I don't know whether it's passed or not, but I think that's a pretty strong indication that they're playing fast and loose. Why would you want to make a government make a vaccine and this is what the opposition is saying, why would you want to make vaccination compulsory when there isn't even a vaccine? What are you talking about?
A new system to control the likes of worlds we've never seen. So, I mean, is it feasible that there could be some sort of new type of vaccine using nanotechnology?
Well, the nanotechnology aspect of it is this, that if you've got a vaccine, you vaccinate people with it, but you also stick in a little chip, effectively, which means that anybody, you can then say who has and who hasn't been vaccinated. And on that basis, you can then say everybody who's got the chip can go to parties, can go to football matches and all the rest of it. And then you just check everybody on the way in, blip, 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 they're all chipped. And of course, the more extreme conspiracy theorists on the internet, and of course all to do with the Book of Revelation, all the rest of it, you're very well aware of this, they think that that's what this is all about. I'm not of that ilk. I don't tend to believe in prophecies, and I think we're going to come on to something about this in a minute, but I certainly don't trust these people as far as I can spit.
DARPA, Whitney, is also talking about being involved in this. That, I think, is something like a defense evaluation research project in the United States. DARPA is apparently very much involved in this whole world of high-tech vaccines, and so obviously we'll be looking into this. But it is actually a military project, I believe.
That's right. I mean, the various biological warfare facilities in the West, including Porton Down, of course, are supposedly there in case an enemy, whoever that might be, Al-Qaeda that we've set up, for example, are developing biological weaponry. And therefore, they need to experiment with it so that they can block. The US hasn't ratified the Convention Against Biological Weapons. They signed it, but they haven't ratified it. And they've got all of these biological warfare labs around the world.
Now, what's the difference?
Well, what the difference is you basically say you're not going to develop biological weapons, but by not ratifying it, it means that you can, and they are, and they're not developing them necessarily inside the US, so they're in foreign countries, basically client states like Georgia, and there's lots of questions about what's been going on there, because they seem to have been experimenting on the local population with biological weaponry. And the fact is that when they say that there's a threat of biological weaponry from Al-Qaeda, which they run anyway, what they mean is we're developing biological weaponry. And that is possibly what's going on here. This is not just a random event. It may be that we're already in World War III and COVID-19 is part of it.
Whitney Webb points to an article at Wired.com from 2011. DARPA say do away with antibiotics, then destroy all pathogens. So what she's trying to do here, I suppose, is to point out that actually there may be an enormous amount of military big pharma research that we're not privy to. This article says Americans may be on the verge of a post-antibiotic era. And that's what the Pentagon's far-out research agency, DARPA, is after. As long as they've got a replacement at the ready, in the military's latest round of small business solicitations, DARPA is making a long-shot request for all-out replacements to antibiotics. The decades of old standard for killing or injuring bacteria. The emerging field of nanomedicine would be used to fight bacteria. So there's a lot of nanotechnology involved in medicine, which we've not really been talked about. And it certainly doesn't seem to have been closely looked at by the regulators here in Britain, that sort of NICE and people like this.
Well, obviously, inevitably, there's an awful lot about this kind of world that we don't know. What goes on in Porton Down? What goes on in there? We don't know. We do know that the Russians dismantled their chemical warfare facility in Uzbekistan, because Craig Murray, who was the British ambassador there at the time, so was there when the whole place was dismantled. In theory, nobody is supposed to be developing chemical or biological weapons. In practice, the West has been developing and deploying biological and chemical weaponry, at the same time as accusing everybody else of doing it. Now, I don't trust any of these people at all. I don't really know what's going on, nor do you, but I'm pretty certain that it's not what I would want to be going on. And people need to wake up to how militant and nasty the deep state is embedded within our own societies.
Well, okay, so we've had a good look at the geopolitical situation, China, Russia, the Middle East, and we've also been looking at the whole business of Bill Gates, the Gates Foundation, Big Pharma, and I thought it'd be a good time now to have a look at this new book that's just out, and this is a clip from the BBC World Service, which is reviewing the book. The programme is called The Real Story. The presenter is Ritula Shah. And here she is talking to Jeffrey Robinson, who's the author of The Merger, How Organised Crime is Taking Over the World.
Jeffrey Robinson is our third panellist. He's the author of the books The Laundryman and its sequel, The Merger, How Organised Crime is Taking Over the World. Jeffrey, what's the one thing that surprises you that people perhaps don't know or think about when it comes to organised crime?
Well, the first thing is that they think of criminals. That's wrong. Crime is a business, and organised criminals are businessmen. And I think that if you suddenly realise that it's not about crime, it's about business, and that product doesn't matter, but opportunism does, then that wraps up what Misha said and what Vonder says. These are huge business enterprises who have done what the Harvard School of Business says all businesses must do in a globalized society, which is form joint ventures and strategic alliances. And that's why you have Italian businessmen called the Camorra linked up with Russian businessmen or Nigerian criminal enterprises, or the Colombian cartels. They're all in it for money, which is why when you get to policing, if you go after criminals, you're going to lose. If you go after the businessmen and the money, you stand a chance.
Well, that's a fairly tough thing to say there. That's Jeffrey Robinson, author of The Merger, How Organised Crime is Taking Over the World. Martin, he says basically most of the law enforcement agencies in the world are looking in the wrong places for the criminals.
Well, I mean, let's think of it this way. One of the major criminal enterprises is illegal drugs. And the illegality of the drugs industry means that it's incredibly profitable. If drugs were provided legally, the profit margins would be pretty minimal, like the profit margins on running a pub in this country. But of course, if it's illegal, the profit margins are enormous. And therefore, you can generate huge slush funds, which can be used in various ways. And the alliance between criminal cartels and the intelligence services, particularly, but not exclusively, the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States, is well documented going back to the 1940s. Alfred McCoy's book on the politics of heroin came out in the 1970s. And of course, during the Vietnam War, Air America, which was run by the CIA, was taking drugs from heroin from Vietnam into the United States to fund paramilitary forces inside Vietnam. It's been going on for a very long time. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime had a report coming out in 2009 after the 2008 crash, and the main thrust of the report was that the drug cartels had just washed all their money through the banking system because the banks needed the money and the cartels needed to wash it. That's how tightly webbed together these things are.
Well, how does Bill Gates fit into that then?
Well, Bill Gates, as a big business person, is operating within the same environment as all the rest of them. When he had this pandemic exercise, 201 or whatever it was.
Talking about Event 201.
Event 201, the participants in that were the CIA. So, and as we were mentioning earlier, all of these biological labs that are supposed to be looking into biological threats are funded via the Pentagon, which is a war machine. Are they funding that?
Well, Bill Gates has got quite a lot of strings to his bow, and this is what comes, I suppose, when you're the richest man in the world. He's just re-overtaken the Amazon boss, Jeff Bezos, as the richest man
Bezos
in the world.
Well, Bezos is like a trillionaire this morning, apparently, the first one.
But anyway, I was just reading something saying Bill Gates has just overtaken him in wealth again, because the two of them are kind of
vying. They've got their little competition going, haven't they?
They have. But anyway, Bill Gates is backing a plan to have a video camera watch every inch of the Earth from space. Earth Now, a new satellite project with high-profile benefactors, aims to cover the entire planet in detailed real-time video surveillance, including war zones.
Well, I mean, people are kind of accepting a far higher level of surveillance than they would in the past, because it's because they're basically there's various threats, you know, the pandemic, terrorism, whatever. But of course, and they say, well, if as long as I'm not doing anything wrong, I should be all right. But I ask those people to consider maybe the people that are doing the surveying are themselves the criminals and terrorists that you're frightened of. And then it becomes really sinister, doesn't it? The terrorists are the people with the surveillance equipment. And of course, the linkages between the US military and Islamist terrorism are huge. The Badr Brigade in Iraq this week is saying that US planes and helicopters are being used to ferry ISIS militants from Syria into Iraq. That's what they're saying. But you won't hear that in the mainstream news.
Also, I mean, we talked briefly, Martin, didn't we? We were doing a whole program, really, about the October 1944 nuclear test. Evidence now with documentation and actually bits of uranium discovered in Germany. So that's 9 months before the American nuclear test, the Trinity test, the Manhattan Project test of nuclear weapons. But you mentioned this guy, Klaus Fuchs. Do you want to just say a little bit about him? Because it turns out he's got a bit of a Bristol connection.
Well, Klaus Fuchs was the son of a Protestant pastor in Germany, so he was a German citizen. And as a teenager, he got involved in anti-Nazi activity and drifted towards the Communist Party of Germany. And eventually he fled Germany because he was a communist and came to Britain. But he was also a physicist and he got involved in the, you know, developing the nuclear weaponry. And he eventually, while he was doing that, he was passing information to the Soviets. He was eventually caught by British intelligence and put on trial and convicted of espionage against his adopted country, Britain. And he was sent to prison and he died a couple of years ago in prison here in Britain, unrepentant, because as an anti-Nazi German, he was quite clear that he didn't think he'd done anything wrong from a moral point of view in providing the Soviets with what they needed to build an H-bomb. And what we now know, looking at the documentation that's come out, is that they were definitely discussing the possibility of nuking the Soviet Union at the end of World War II when they didn't have nuclear weapons. So Fuchs actually played a very important role in the Soviet nuclear program, which probably, through deterrence, kept the peace. Can you imagine what would have happened if the Soviets hadn't had nuclear weapons?
Well, we had something in Bristol called the Bristol Physics Lab. Not sure if it still exists. I spoke earlier this week to a former member of the Bristol Physics Lab and a physicist, retired, now living in Wales, Dave Lawton. And he started by explaining to me that there was a very peculiar bloke that turned up, was working at Bristol Physics Lab, that was working as a spy from the CIA in Bristol here.
He was a strange guy. He used to line all the nuts and bolts up, in the nuts and bolts drawer, and I used to shake them up and they'd go back and do it, you know. But then it came to a head when he moved from the particle physics department where I was working, and he moved to X-ray crystallography. Anyway, Martin Price, one of the technicians, we were having a discussion. He said, I'm so paranoid of this guy. He keeps asking me all personal questions. Well, a little while later, Martin did a very naughty thing. He broke open into the guy's locker. He goes, so paranoid. Because we all had lockers to keep your personal belongings. And inside, he found a filing card index system with names of all members of staff on there, even photographs of them, all about them, their political interests and everything like this. Anyway, we confronted him, and the Technicians Union also confronted him. And he said, oh, he also had skeleton keys to get into the other labs, which were locked at night. He said he'd collected this information for his wife because he was thinking having a party for members of staff so she could talk to them on their interests.
Okay, so how were you actually able to prove that he was working for the American government?
Well, the Americans working at Bristol Physics Lab, because Bristol Physics Lab was rather left-wing. And you must remember that in the 1930s, there was a physicist called Klaus Fuchs, who was an atom spy. He got 10 years in this country, and he worked at Bristol Physics Lab. So obviously the Americans are so paranoid at Bristol Physics Lab, that's the Royal Fort, they obviously sent in CIA agents disguised as technicians. Anyway, the university was so freaked out, they made him resign, and where he went, I don't know. But not long after that, they planted another one in there.
Now, you say you were a bit left-wing. Were you leaking secrets to the Soviet Union?
No, no, no. We had Soviet physicists come and visit, because the head of the physics lab, Professor Powell, he was, they were all into peace. They were not into war. They were very anti-war in Bristol Physics Lab.
So that's Dave Lawton there speaking to me earlier this week. And Martin, it's quite obvious there was a bit of a left-wing caucus of anti-war physicists here in Bristol in the Cold War.
Yeah, well, Fuchs, as I say, was a German anti-Nazi activist. And he basically, the British intelligence took quite a while to work out what he was doing, but they did catch him in the end. And he basically said, well, I've done nothing that I'm ashamed of. If I hadn't passed this material to the Soviets, they wouldn't have been able to develop a nuclear program, and you would quite probably have nuked them. But you can't, because they've got the weapons themselves and you can't do it. So, if you know, the arguments against nuclear disarmament are that you've got to have deterrence, and that's why we're supposed to have our nuclear weapons for deterrence, although NATO doctrine is to use them first. But I don't think that if the Soviets had if the Soviets and the Chinese didn't have nuclear weapons, they'd probably been completely wiped out by now. So it's probably just as well they have.
Okay, well, we're going to listen now to some interviews to do with the censorship at YouTube. I amazingly had one of my YouTubes restored for the first time this week. I don't know. Of course, one of the problems is, I mean, I've been monetizing for quite a while, and then when I did my, I suppose you'd call it a film, it was really just a radio interview with some pictures on it, called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit, which got 1.75 million hits, and I was getting a bit of money in. Suddenly YouTube then decided to demonetize me. Well, I'm not the only one. There's many people, when they start to be very successful and their videos go viral, after putting all that work in to build up the channel, YouTube will then switch off the bank account, basically saying, oh, well, trying to pass the buck to the advertiser, saying, oh, the advertisers don't want to advertise with you anymore. Well, of course, this is extremely dodgy, extremely political. So we're going to have a listen now to someone called Sean from the SGT report. Now, he's got a few more subscribers than me. He's up over 500,000 subscribers. And here he is talking about being demonetized after putting up an interview the other week with a guy called James Perloff, and we'll be hearing a bit more from Perloff. And I rather like doing this. When you see something's being censored, you know, I like to have a good old look at it. What is it they don't want us to know?
April 21st, 2020. That was the date I released my video with James Perloff titled COVID-19 and Their Beast System on the Record. Well, YouTube removed that video just a few days ago, and I emailed James Perloff about it. Big Brother strikes again. They're all in on it. You want to talk about conspiracies? This is the ultimate conspiracy. They don't want us talking about alternative therapeutics to a Gates vaccine. They're terminating content on YouTube containing discussions about this pandemic. And when I say they're all in on it, friends, the ultimate conspiracy, the billionaire behind TikTok has just committed $10 million to a Bill Gates-backed accelerator for COVID-19 therapeutic treatments. That's right, the Chinese billionaire founder of the social media app TikTok and its parent company, ByteDance, has pledged $10 million to the project founded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to find and fast-track a vaccine. I would be willing to bet that if Zhang Yiming, the 36-year-old Chinese billionaire and founder of TikTok, if Zhang had a YouTube channel, it would probably not be demonetized as mine was today. I want to show you guys this. Your channel is no longer eligible to monetize. Upon a recent review, we found that a significant portion of your channel is not in line with YouTube's monetization policies. Please review our feedback below and make changes. And what is their feedback? Harmful content, content that focuses on controversial issues that is harmful to viewers. Now, friends, they're telling me that I can make changes to my channel, which means deleting videos and interviews, which I refuse to do. But if I do that, I can reapply after June 12, 2020. And, friends, I refuse to delete my free speech and my conversations with others about fact-based quantifiables just simply because YouTube doesn't like it and they refuse to give me advertising until I appease them. I will not appease them. And I'm not begging anyone for help. My channel has always been a public service and in the interest of truth and real journalism. But I don't have malevolent globalist benefactors like Jeff Bezos, who controls the Washington Post, and George Soros, who controls Media Matters and so much more. So if you have ever found value in this channel and what it stands for, I would ask you to consider visiting my Patreon page and becoming a patron in the continued fight for real news and real journalism 24/7.
Okay, that's Sean from, that's all he calls himself, Sean from the SGT report. But he's done much better than me with subscribers, Martin, and up until the other day, he was making a living at it. Now, he's all been switched off.
Well, YouTube, of course, is a private organisation run for profit. And just like the Daily Telegraph or any other private organisation, they can decide who they want to push and who they don't want to push. But, of course, the problem is with these YouTube, Google, Facebook, is they're effectively monopolies. And if you can't get access to via them, then you can't get access to people who might want to see your stuff. Ultimately, I would argue that these things should be treated as a public service and that freedom of speech should be guaranteed by law. And that doesn't mean stuff that, people should be allowed to say anything they like within the law. And there shouldn't be any kind of censorship of what they say. But as you know, the media isn't a public service. It's a for-profit setup. And it's also
well, the BBC, Martin, the BBC isn't it?
Well, yeah, but the BBC has a more liberal policy on what things, you know, they have to be in balance. They're regulated by Ofcom and all the rest of it. I think ultimately that's the way it's got to be. But of course, the BBC itself, because of the license fee, they can be bullied by the government of the day by simply saying, well, we're going to reduce your license fee.
Yeah, well, also, they can be funded by the Gates Foundation too, can't they?
Well, indeed, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there's also, as you know, there are joint projects between the BBC and other organisations.
All I can say is back in my day at the BBC, there was no Gates Foundation funding us then. And then we had John Burt, who was the Secretary General when I was working there, who brought in what they call producer choice, which actually gave producers less choice, which I think is fairly Orwellian. But anyway, the civil liberties aspect of this is, I mean, you know, the idea of a free press, we're kind of caught up in that because we're trying to get back onto FM. We're lobbying the management team at BCFM to go back on FM, and hopefully we'll be doing that sometime soon. But the civil liberties aspect was touched on by James Perloff, the interview with Sean, which was cut off then. So let's have a listen now to James Perloff. What the interview, the actual video which was taken down is called COVID 1984. And here is James Perloff, a US blogger. He's actually very good, quite interesting. I mean, you might say he's a bit anti-Semitic in that he does confuse sometimes Zionists with Jews, which is extremely problematic. But the actual, what he's saying here makes a lot of sense. This is about civil liberties.
The coronavirus is very handy because you can't see it. So you just say, oh, well, it could be on that object. So you can't buy it. So the case I was giving in Howard County, Indiana, was books. You can't buy books there because, so that's a modern form of book burning. But another one too is Google is now tracking people's movements with using their cell phones to protect the government. And of course, this is all in the name of, tracking the spread of coronavirus and preventing, illegal social gatherings. But overseas, it's even worse. You know, in Singapore, if you stand too close, and you can go to jail for up to 6 months and be fined up to $7,000. In Tunisia, this is on YouTube, they've got these robocops patrolling the streets. Now, they're not autonomous. They're controlled by cops in offices, but they're these robocops are demanding that people stop and present their travel permits. In Greece, Bishop Seraphim Sturgulius was arrested for opening his church for worship. And the Danish parliament in Denmark passed a law authorizing the government to quarantine unvaccinated citizens without their consent. So we're seeing the formation of a worldwide police state. This is what we've been talking about for years coming true.
Perloff also talks about Bill Gates and his wonderful vaccines as well.
Gates' obsession with vaccines seems fueled by a messianic conviction that he is ordained to save the world with technology and a godlike willingness to experiment with the lives of lesser humans. And it gives many examples of the damage Bill Gates' vaccines have done. Let me just give you two. I'm quoting Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Quote, promising to eradicate polio with $1.2 billion, Gates took control of India's National Advisory Board and mandated 50 polio vaccines, up from five, to every child before age five. Indian doctors blamed the Gates campaign for a devastating vaccine-strained polio epidemic that paralyzed 496,000 children. China, that's 500,000 children paralyzed. In 2017, the Indian government dialed back Gates' vaccine regimen and evicted Gates and his cronies from the NAB. Polio paralysis rates then dropped precipitously. And one other example that Robert F. Kennedy gives, again quoting, in 2010, Gates committed $10 billion to the WHO, World Health Organization, promising to reduce population in part through new vaccines. 2014, Kenya's Catholic Doctors Association accused the WHO of chemically sterilizing millions of unwilling Kenyan women with a phony tetanus vaccine campaign. Independent labs found the sterility formula in every vaccine tested. After denying the charges, WHO finally admitted it had been developing the sterility vaccines for over a decade. And Kennedy writes, Gates appeared gleeful that the COVID-19 crisis will now give him the opportunity to force his third world vaccine programs onto American children. End quote. And, you know, Sean, one way I know that Bill Gates is not sincere about improving people's health, when you ever see him talk, and I've not seen all his talks, but he never talks about getting exercise or vitamin C or vitamin D or improving your immune system, take it. He only talks about the vaccines. And I think that's here we want to close again with quotes directly from Bill Gates. He says, quote, it is fair to say things will not go back truly to normal until we have a vaccine that we've gotten out basically to the entire world, end quote. And I want to talk about how ridiculous this is, this idea of a coronavirus vaccine. I'm going to quote Stefano Montaneri, is an Italian nanopathologist, and this is what he says, quote, you cannot vaccinate against the common cold, which coronavirus causes the common cold, because the common cold does not give immunity. In the course of a life, a person can have cold 200 times, and in no time will that cold give immunity against the next version, end quote. So what he's saying here, Sean, is that every year the flu virus and the cold virus, they mutate. That's why we keep getting flus and why we keep getting the cold. You cannot vaccinate against the coronavirus. It's simply going to mutate into something new. So even if you got Bill Gates' vaccine, guess what? Next year there'll be a new mutation in the coronavirus, and it won't work anymore. Plus the fact, and Dr. B confirmed this to me, by the way, hydroxychloroquine combined with zinc already gives a very good effective rate of cure, reduction in symptoms to coronavirus victims.
So there is James Perloff. None of us are doctors and experts, but he's, I think, looking at the civil liberties aspects, the robocops, the vicars being arrested, and this sort of thing. But also, Martin, pointing out quite a lot of hypocrisies and contradictions in the whole idea of the vaccine.
Well, I'm sceptical whether you can have a vaccine against something like this. As he points out, we haven't got a vaccine against the common cold, and we haven't developed a vaccine for HIV. Although, of course, HIV, they've developed drugs which can basically prolong your life, even though they don't get rid of the HIV infection. I think, coming back to the wider question of freedom of speech, people should be allowed to say whatever they like, but inevitably there's going to be some people say, well, you know, that doesn't mean you're right, because you're allowed to say what you want. People should be allowed to say what they want, but you've got to accept that basically you might be wrong. And that goes for him, goes for us, goes for everybody.
It does seem, though, that YouTube has taken a particularly tough line, and it is where many, many people get their information from. Certainly yeah. we do, you know. When suddenly something disappears, and, you know, I've had quite a few of my videos taken down. You know, one of our earliest discussions, which was looking at the virus, Martin, you know, looking at ID 2020 and looking at the event 201 when I was still out in New Zealand. That was just, you know, removed without any, you know, basically without explaining why. You know, so, of course, if they what YouTube say to you is you can now appeal this decision, but they don't give you any information about what they base the decision to take your video down on. Anyway, let's have another listen, because I like listen. I've never really come across James Perloff before, and I was annoyed to hear that he's been taken off YouTube. I mean, I would have thought if he's got nothing useful or worthwhile to say, or it's what he's saying is dangerous in some way, that they would just ignore it. This is talking about his book Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and here he does a good job on stringing together why it is that just looking at one issue, I mean, we've looked at 9/11, haven't we? But there's lots and lots of other issues around that you need to understand a much deeper version of what, to really understand what's going on. He really puts it here as putting together various bits of a jigsaw. This is James Perloff again.
You know, if you just took one piece of it, no piece of it would supply the evidence. But, you know, you look at the League of Nations, and you look at the fact that because of the U.S. Senate's rejection of the League of Nations in 1919, they wouldn't ratify the Versailles Treaty that created the League. Then you see the Council on Foreign Relations created as a direct result of that. They were incorporated in 1921, and this Council on Foreign Relations, which is a subject of my earlier book, The Shadows of Power, has dominated the presidential cabinets, whether the guy in the Oval Office is a Republican or a Democrat. And then you look at the UN being created by these same guys, and these same guys create the World Bank and the IMF. And I know that officially those were instituted at the Bretton Woods Conference, but the Council on Foreign Relations was fomenting those even before then. Then you look at these regional bodies like the EU and NAFTA, and you just see all these globalist measures taking place collectively, and even a drive for one world religion. So it's really, I don't think there's any one piece of evidence in there. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, and if you just talk about 9/11 to people, they say, well, our own government wouldn't do that to us, and if they did, they tell us about it on TV. So you have to give people the whole picture, and that's what I try to do as concisely as possible in this book. So the first chapter is about, it's not just 9/11, it's the sinking of the Maine, it's the Lusitania, it's the foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, it's the artificially created Korean War, it's Tonkin Gulf, it's the no WMDs in Iraq. This has been going on for a long time, and then I say, well, why do you have this pattern? And so we talk about the fact that the same guys are running the government. I talk about the Council on Foreign Relations in Chapter 2, chapters about the Fed and how it's wrecked their economy. And I, just to run them down, then I talk about the ways that run America, and then I talk about the Vietnam War because it was such an important event, and then I talk about the plan today with the NAFTA, as we've already touched on. Then I talk about media control, and I've got a chapter on the ways they've destroyed national sovereignty. I talk about their international control structures like the Bilderbergers and Trilateral Commission. There's a chapter on environmentalism, which is a tool for control, excuse for control. There's a chapter on Zionism and a whole chapter on 9/11, and don't you need at least a chapter on that? And then chapters on the control of the arts, and a chapter on the war on faith, and a chapter on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and the control on cyber tyranny and on vaccines, on weather control. So I try to give people the whole picture so that they're not getting just one piece of the jigsaw puzzle, because one piece of a jigsaw puzzle, it looks like just a piece of color with no meaning. But if you take a piece of a jigsaw puzzle and you snap it into the entire puzzle, now you see what the big picture is, and now that piece makes sense to you. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book.
So that's James Perloff there, speaking about his book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. Well, one, you know, all sorts of interesting stuff in there, but one thing jumps out to me, Martin. I wonder if it's the same to you when he starts talking about the protocols of Zion, because this was used actually by Adolf Hitler, wasn't it, to as part of his campaign against the Jews.
It is, and of course, he may be right about lots of what he's saying, but when you start talking about the protocols of the Elders of Zion, you're talking about people basically predicting the future as a prophecy. And of course, the mainstream historical analysis of the protocols of the Elders of Zion is that it was actually a document created by the Okhrana, which was the Tsarist secret police, as a mechanism for persecuting the Jewish community inside Russia at that time and making them appear to be problematic.
Can I just say, Martin, that, I mean, my view of this is that it is a completely fictional document. To me, it doesn't read like a real document. Not only that, you know, most of the historical and analysis that's been done over the years would back that up. I mean, it doesn't even look like it to me like a very good forgery.
No, but it was basically created as part of a psychological warfare operation by the Tsarist secret police. And then it was picked up and run with. I do not believe in prophecy. I wouldn't try to predict who would win a match between Liverpool and Chelsea. Never mind what's going to happen in 100 years' time. But I do know that the Council for Foreign Relations is run by oligarchs and that they're trying to control the world's resources for the benefit of a corrupt.
I mean, the point here is that, I mean, you know, I think, you know, maybe I'm just looking at James Perloff for the first time really and thinking, well, he seems to have got much useful information here, but there's a few little poison pills in there too. But then that is our job as journalists, and it's our job as readers of books, is to make our own decisions, to decide for ourselves what we're going to take and what we're not going to take. And really, it's not, I don't think, YouTube's job to try and do that for us, to say, well, you know, well, this person has mentioned this and therefore they've got to go. I mean, it's, you know, that's at least my opinion of it. But anyway, I thought we'd go and have a listen, because he's talking there about the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group, which are two very powerful Rockefeller Foundation-funded organisations that have grown up over the years. Obviously, other people involved in funding Bilderberg and founding it, like the CIA, but Council on Foreign Relations certainly played an enormous part. The War and Peace Studies Group in the 1943 in the US was already planning Bilderberg 12 years before it ever first had its first meeting. But let's have a listen now to Neil Ferguson. He's the biographer of the Rothschilds. He's also quite well known. Marty, do you want to say something a little bit about Neil Ferguson? Because he's a...
Niall Ferguson.
Niall Ferguson, yeah.
Well, he's a rather right-wing historian. I've read several of his books, and they're quite interesting.
Well, have you read a book of his, the latest one, called The Square and the Tower Networks?
I did try to read it, but I found myself so annoyed with its pro-establishment bias that I decided I wasn't going to read all.
Anyway, we're going to have a little extract from Neil Ferguson now, speaking on C-SPAN about this book, The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power from Freemasons to Facebook.
Are you involved with the Schwarzman College?
Yes.
And the reason I bring it up, because I looked up the advisory committee of the Schwarzman College, and it just seemed to me to be one of the great networks that
Absolutely.
You could possibly put together. And I'm going to read down the list.
Yes.
Sarkozy, Tony Blair, Brian Mulroney, Kevin Rudd from Australia, Henry Kissinger, Colin Powell, Hank Paulson, Jim Wolfenson, Bob Rubin, Condi Rice, Rick Levin, who used to be the president of Yale, Richard Haass, the Council on Foreign Relations, Yo-Yo Ma, and others. If I were an outsider looking in, I'd say that's the Illuminati. It's Council on Foreign Relations. It's and what does that mean?
Yeah, well, it means that Steve Schwarzman, who's the brains and the money behind the Schwarzman College, has the Rolodex of Rolodexes, and Steve was able to bring this group together, as well as lesser fry like me, to do the teaching. There are two points that I think one can make. The first is that clearly there is an enormously important network, and you've just listed some of the key nodes in that network. You could find similar names, similar combinations of names, if you went to the World Economic Forum or the Council on Foreign Relations, or you just hung out in New York and the Four Seasons. This is a real elite network, and it is it's very important to recognize that it exists and is not dreamt up by conspiracy theorists. It's not an invention. These mostly men know one another. Second point, this is an elite that seems, in this case, to be trying its best to do something that I think is good, namely to build a new kind of network that connects China to the West. The Schwarzman Scholarship Program was dreamt up by Steve as a kind of version of the Rhodes Scholarships, which used to bring people to Oxford, still bring people to study in Oxford. And the Steve Schwarzman vision was, well, we need to do something similar so that there is more understanding between the future leaders of China and the future leaders of Western countries. I think that's a very good idea. I think the program is a terrific innovation, and I see when I go there, terrific students from all around the world, not just Americans, it's from all around the world, getting to understand China better and studying alongside Chinese students at what is the equivalent of MIT or Harvard in China.
Have you been to the Bilderberg meetings?
Yes.
Have you been a member of the Trilateral Commission?
No.
Barney Miller, the television show. This is a 42-second clip, 1981, when this happened, and this is just a television show. Let's run.
All right, what is the Trilateral Commission? It's an organization founded in 1973 by David Rockefeller to bring together business and political leaders from the United States, Europe, Japan, so they could work together for better economic and political cooperation between their nations.
Well, that's what they'd like us to believe. But you see, what they're really up to is a scheme to plant their own loyal members in positions of power in this country, to work to erase national boundaries and create an international community, and in time, bring about a one-world government with David Rockefeller calling the shots.
Sir, what do you think?
Well, there you have the conspiracy theory that we were talking about earlier, that they say they're meeting in order to improve the world and improve economic policy coordination, but actually they're hatching a plan to erase national boundaries and establish world government under David Rockefeller. So the stated objectives are the objectives, and the notion that there is going to be a world government at the end of it is the fantasy. Now, I can't speak for the Trilateral Commission, I'm not involved with that, but I can assure you that although the meetings of the Bilderberg group are closed, nobody ever mentioned world government to me at those meetings. On the contrary, I'm always struck by the extent to which at such gatherings the discussion is reactive. You know, here's another fine mess the world is in. Is there anything we can do about it? You don't have a strong sense of there being control. Even the word power seems strangely inappropriate. This network is commenting on the world, exchanging ideas. I'm sure there's an element of business involved too. But we shouldn't exaggerate the power of even the most exclusive networks. What's striking to me when I interact with these groups is not their power, but often their sense of powerlessness. If you think about the events of 2016, just to take an example, not many members of the supposed world government planned that Britain would vote to leave the European Union and that Donald Trump would become president of the United States. Donald Trump is definitely not somebody who gets invited to those meetings. So then, or for example, take the financial crisis, the events of 2008-9. Nobody sat there at the Bilderberg meeting in 2008 saying, I think what we really need for the world government is a massive financial crisis. Now, what's striking when you spend time in these rarefied circles is the lack of power. Influence, yes. These people, the people who are involved with the Schwarzman College, very influential people. But I think that power tends to be exaggerated. And if there is a world government being put together, it's not doing very well. It's not going very well. But I don't think that's ever been the project. It's interesting, actually, to mention David Rockefeller. I read the other day that Rockefeller, whose network predated the age of the internet, and existed on a giant Rolodex, was one of the biggest networks of, probably of all time, in the sense that with the limits of technology, there's only so many people that you can keep a tab on. And 100,000 names, I seem to remember, were in this giant system of index cards, including some of the names that you read. Certainly Henry Kissinger was in that list. I'm in the midst of writing Kissinger's biography, and for me, part of the way to understand Kissinger's rise from being an academic and a public intellectual to being an extraordinarily influential Secretary of State is to understand that network, and to understand the ways in which it worked, so that his influence extended beyond government, extended across borders, was in many ways global. To me, this is historically very interesting, but one has to talk about it and write about it with out exaggerating the power of the network. The influence, yes, but I think the power was more circumscribed, much as was true in the case of the Rothschild Bank, which I wrote about back in the 1990s. Yes, the Rothschilds were probably the richest people in the world in the 19th century, and their banks were tremendously influential in the way that the bond market evolved, and therefore in the way that governments could borrow. But at the time, conspiracy theorists said that they had total power over the world, that they determined whether there was war or whether there was peace, that they controlled the central banks, etc. Well, I showed in my book, The World's Banker, that was mostly untrue, that the Rothschilds couldn't determine war and peace, and very often would be frustrated and would suffer losses when wars broke out. So I think the challenge for the historian who wants to write about networks is striking that balance between delineating the influence, trying to measure it and calibrate it, and also identifying the limits of the network's power.
Martin, the idea of influence and power being two different things, he's saying there effectively that the Bilderberg and people like this are really just talking shops, that they don't actually have any real power.
Well, I mean, the more extreme conspiracy theories, which see one overarching conspiracy running everything, I think Niall Ferguson is probably right to say that's wrong. But on the other hand, he's an establishment figure. And basically, by writing the kind of books he writes, he is basically tackling the sort of topics we tackle, but from an establishment perspective. So he's giving the kind of, this isn't really dangerous. They have influence, but they don't have power. I don't really know what the difference between influence and power is. I mean, is there a difference? If I can influence you to do something, that's a power, isn't it? I think the Ferguson is an intelligent, but very flawed individual. He's, for example, one of the things he did is he wrote a book about the British Empire where he basically said the US have taken over from the British Empire and it's a good thing, and that the US Empire is a good thing. If you remember, we went to see him speak in Temple Meads
some years ago.
In the M-shed, yeah. And he was basically saying that, He was basically covering up for the CIA and others and their bad behaviour. He's a very establishment figure, and his books are well written and he's well researched, but basically he covers the kind of territory we cover, but from the point of view of establishment.
Okay.
That's what I'd say about him.
He's talking about a world government maybe coming out through, just without actually this being a deliberate conspiracy to make it happen. It's going to kind of happen anyway.
Well, if you think about it, there is constant negotiation going on between the powerful people in the world. I mean, the Chinese and the US have diplomatic relations with each other, although that may end sometime soon.
But Kissinger has said, hasn't he, and we covered this a few weeks ago, Henry Kissinger, on this pandemic crisis, he's saying, well, look, you know, you're going to have a world government, otherwise the world is going to catch fire. So he's saying basically, I mean, the thing is with Kissinger, of course, you're never quite sure whether he's giving you a genuine warning or whether there's a bit of menace, a bit of threat in that.
Well, ultimately, what's going on is that the oligarchy in the West, with their Israeli allies, are trying to take over the world. And there's various other forces at work which are trying to stop them. And ultimately, this will lead to World War III, probably, and there will be a decision. Ultimately, if we get through this next phase of human history, there will be some kind of world coordination. I mean, it's pretty obvious that we're going to have one. The question is, who's going to run it? Is it going to be run by the ordinary people, or is it going to be run by these rapacious oligarchs?
It's funny you're saying that, because is it, who's going to run it? The World Health Organization. But the thing is, a lot of these international organizations...
The World Health Organization has just been defunded by the US.
Well, a lot of these international organizations, though, are actually controlled by one faction or another faction. There's very few that aren't nowadays.
That's right. The UN, basically, is based in New York. So, for example, the Iranian foreign minister was forbidden to come to speak at it.
And the Venezuelans. Yeah.
Well, exactly. So, in other words, it isn't a one-government world. What you've got is the rapacious oligarchs which run the Western powers, and they've been running it for hundreds of years, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, all the rest of them. They want to run the world, and they don't want a communist Chinese upstart to take any of their power. And they don't want an independent Britain which didn't have nuclear weapons and wasn't in NATO. So if Corbyn came to be prime minister, you could be sure that they'd be working to undermine him, even if he'd managed to get there. And we know what we're up against.
Okay,
and,
but
they're playing for world domination.
These guys would argue with you, Martin. They say, well, we own the world, and when we should control it.
Well, that's what they say, is they've got people like Niall Ferguson, who are very well paid, to come out and say, there's nothing to see here, folks. It's just, we're all just doing our best to try and
anyway, one of the major struggles, of course, is the free press, which we're hoping to be carrying on being part of, a little corner of freedom here in an old Templar port, the Port of Bristol, close by to, the Bristol Temple Meads and all that. But we're trying to do our best. One of the things that really annoys me is when someone interesting like James Perloff gets censored from YouTube. So let's hear now again from him from the same video, the censored one, COVID-1984, it's called. Where are we heading? This is James Perloff's take.
The whole idea of a digital ID, quoting Bill Gates, he said, quote, eventually we'll have some digital certificates to show who has recovered or been tested recently, or when we have a vaccine, who has received it. So it's very easy to see where this is going down the pike, Sean, that eventually, say the next flu season, they'll say that the after they get us sort of back on board with the economy, they'll say, COVID-19 has come back. COVID-19 has come back. We have to be in lockdown. And what are Americans going to say? Oh, no. We can't have another lockdown. We can't afford another lockdown. So what's going to happen is, or what they'd like to have happen is that Bill Gates will say, well, no problem. We've got a vaccine ready now. All you've got to do, if you want to work and travel and go to the grocery to shop, all you got to do is get your vaccine, and then we'll implant a RFID chip under your skin. Wherever you go, you just get that thing get wanded, and it'll verify that you've had your vaccine. Of course, that would also enable the government to track your whereabouts for the rest of your life, especially once we're into the 5G grid. So, you know, Sean, this is just amazing to me. You know, if we go to the Bible and we go to the book of Revelation, chapter 13, it says, and the second beast required all people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or their forehead so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark. Now, Bill Gates, who's part of this whole digital, ID 2020, which has their own website, where they've got the Rockefeller Foundation and the Microsoft images right next to each other as part of, as among their partners, right? They want a global ID along with a global vaccine for the entire planet and a cashless society, as you were saying, that they're stopping taking cash because it might have this gremlin-like COVID-19 cootie on it if you take a dollar bill. So what they're talking about is right out of what's predicted in the Bible. It's pretty frightening to see it, the things that we've been talking about for years, to actually becoming true.
So this is one of James Perloff's things, Martin. It'd be interesting to hear what your take is. He's someone that doesn't believe in prophecy. He's saying some of this stuff, it could have been prophesied in the Bible.
Well, as I say, I wouldn't try and prophesy who's going to win the 330 at Newmarket. So I don't accept that. I think there's a lot of people think that. That's for sure. That's definitely the case. And of course, it may well be that people like Gates and Kissinger and the others, they're influenced by the Book of Revelation. So they may be consciously or unconsciously fulfilling the prophecy.
But certainly, I mean, their attitude surely is that this is a useful thing, that if we can spin it so that it looks like, you know, where the gap, good guys and the good guys are the bad guys, that they see this as an opportunity to actually feed on this and turn it to their own advantage.
All right, well, let's put it this way. If they come up with a vaccine, I'm going to be very, very suspicious. It may well be the case, as after the anthrax attacks after 9/11, which definitely came from Fort Detrick, but loads of people at the top in the US, including Bush, have been given Cyprian, I think it's called, which is a pill which counteracts anthrax. So there's definitely foreknowledge there. Okay. Now, it may well be that they're going to try and use this to, as suggested, to make a compulsory vaccine. I sent you stuff from the Nigerian press, which I think should definitely be on the show page so people can check what's going on in Nigeria. They're definitely trying to push this, but we'll come back to what we said earlier, and various people have said this. I can't remember who exactly said it on this show. It's quite possible that there is no vaccine for COVID. It's a cold virus. We haven't got vaccines for colds. So if that's the case, then there's no way that they can push a vaccine compulsorily on everybody because there ain't a vaccine. And that's what the opposition in Nigeria have been saying. Why are you saying we're going to have compulsory vaccination? You haven't even got a vaccine. What are you talking about?
So we'll leave the last word to James Perloff, who is convinced that there's some biblical perspective on all of this. And I find it quite shocking that YouTube can censor this sort of thing. I mean, surely Christian attitude and interpretation should be allowed to be seen. So we leave you with James Perloff. Is world government actually a good idea from a biblical perspective?
2 Thessalonians 2:3 and 4 says, quote, "Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day," meaning the end of days, "will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction, who will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God," unquote, for the Bible. And, you know, there's this plan in Israel, of course, to rebuild the temple. That is not, we're not supposed to do that. Jesus pronounced a curse on the temple. This whole idea is satanic. But there's definitely this plan of Satan to set himself or some sort of proxy up in Jerusalem over greater Israel, which would be the capital of this world government, and to oppress mankind for what the Bible predicts will be a period of 3.5 years. So it is both human in that you have these banksters who are promised, you know, mansions and power in return for their favors. But you, at the top of the very, very top, you do have a Luciferian agenda, as I said, Bohemian Grove and Satan worship that various intelligence analysts have talked about these people doing, shows that it is Luciferian. And again, that affirms what we were talking about earlier, how this is not a beneficial but an evil agenda that is the end game of this world government.
So that's James Perloff there winding up this program, and I'll put some links onto the censored YouTube video. Someone else has popped it up somewhere else, and so you can have a look at that if you like. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCAFM weekend. You can listen on Sunday evenings at 7 to Danny Loch. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be here on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m, but it hasn't appeared so far. Listen out again at 10 on Monday. We'll be back on FM soon, Pat Hart winning. Do please join us for the politics show late afternoon next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
white in the Caucasian Times. Are you a drug dealer? And if so, why?
Gerald Hawksworth, White Man's Gazette. Why are our prisons so overpopulated with black men?
Excuse me, right here. Excuse me, yes.
Peter Clanning, the White Street Journal. Why is it that most violent crimes are committed by black American males?
I'm just a young black man trying to be paid so I could be like the other man and have it made. Life in the city is rough. Welfare don't pay enough. A good job for the young black man is a buffer. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. I only rob the rich to feed my family, and now they call me a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. 'Cause I'm a menace to society. 'Cause I'm a menace to society. Good job in a place like the Steel Mill sounds good, but I make more money from my neighborhood, and my neighborhood keeps both pockets fat, so I keep going back. That's where the money's at. Black from hell, that's who I am and where I've been. Task force rolls by, I grin. Then I commence to collecting my mail, hoping and praying not to end up in the jail cell. Mama's whole life is dependent on me, 'cause it's hard to survive on AFDC. Food stamp, free milk and cheese. When I think about it, hit another liquor store and yell freeze. Everybody on the floor. Then I empty the cash drawer and run for the front door. This is the reason why, you see, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm called a menace to society. I'm a menace to society.
Furthermore, I feel the needs of the black community has yet to be met. Our federal government and its corporate allies has the means necessary to put an end to this political oppression, which continues to keep the African American struggling for survival.
The streets are unsafe. With a brother like me, see, I take your car, VCR, and your TV. I drive away singing songs on your radio. My conscience starts talking to me, saying way to go. 'Cause once again, my family can be fed, the rent is paid. So we can rest ahead. I look forward to a brighter day. All I can do is pray and hope to pray. Task force is brutal, and I'm angry. The DA sees a brother like me and wants to hang me. Run across a brother like me and can't hack it. Jack a young punk quick. For a jacket, I run the streets just to get my grit on, so my family can have some decent furniture to sit on. So don't try to tell me how to be, 'cause I'ma just be me, sign menace to society. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. Yes, I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society.
Grave, result of a drive-by. I hate it 'cause I know it makes my mother cry. Her whole life is a nervous wreck, and I'm a social reject trying to get a paycheck. Society is giving birth to a fool like me. I'm a T-H-R-E-A-T, so they label me lazy. They say I'm uneducated, violent, and crazy. But I'm a young black man trying to be paid so I can be like the other man and have it made. Life in the city is rough. Welfare don't quite pay enough. A job for the young black man is a cover. In order to survive, somebody's gotta suffer. They say I'm a menace to society, but society's a menace to me. I'm a menace to society. I'm a menace to society. They say I'm a menace to society. Society's a menace to me. Come on.